Fires are always burning in the Amazon, but wildfires have surged since this time last year, according to Brazil's space agency. Satellites have spotted more than 9,500 wildfires this past week. It's Thursday, August 22nd. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown. Climate activists have been pushing the Democratic Party to hold a debate on their issue. Most candidates have clear plans to combat climate change, with Bernie Sanders releasing his yesterday. Also, researchers collect millions of DNA samples and health records around the world, but mostly from people of European ancestry. Now they're working to make those samples more diverse.
Understanding ancestry, race, ethnicity is an area that we're going to see a tremendous, tremendous amount of work in over the next 10 years.
On Wall Street, stocks are poised to close the day mixed. It's 4:01. Now this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump is preparing for the G7 summit in France, where the U.S.'s tariffs dispute with other countries is expected to figure prominently. Trump is still rejecting warnings that the U.S. may be headed for a recession, in large part as a result of the trade war with China and a slowdown in global economic growth. The leaders are also expected to discuss their differences over Iran as well as climate change. Meanwhile, Democratic Party officials meeting in San Francisco today are rejecting the idea of holding a presidential primary debate that's focused solely on climate change. NPR's Jeff Brady reports the activist group Sunrise Movement had campaigned for the climate debate.
Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez says climate change should be a key topic this election, and already it has received more attention than past elections. But Perez argues that allowing one single-issue debate would prompt calls for many more debates on other important topics. After the party's Resolutions Committee voted down the proposal, Sunrise Movement activists disrupted the meeting by walking out and singing. Sunrise organizers say climate change deserves more attention because it affects everyone, and they argue highlighting the issue will energize young voters who are more likely to vote Democratic. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Harvey Weinstein could be facing yet another accuser today. Manhattan's district attorney confirms a new indictment against the former movie mogul. NPR's Rose Friedman reports Weinstein is scheduled to be arraigned Monday.
Harvey Weinstein's trial is scheduled to start in just a few weeks. He's charged with 5 counts of sexual assault against 2 different women. Now, the DA has announced a new indictment indicating that Weinstein will be facing one more alleged victim. It's possible that his trial will be pushed back to give his legal team time to respond. The DA will also call in other alleged victims to try to establish a pattern of behavior by Weinstein. Weinstein was publicly accused of rape and sexual harassment by dozens of women after reports of his alleged misconduct were published in the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine in 2017. His case became the catalyst for the Me Too movement. Rose Friedman, NPR News, New York.
Federal agents are confirming sweeping arrests of online scammers through a network based in Los Angeles. They've announced a 252-count federal grand jury indictment against 80 people, most of whom are believed to be of Nigerian descent. Authorities accuse the defendants of carrying out various scams. Some targeted the elderly. U.S. Attorney Nick Hanna says others targeted people who thought they were dealing with legitimate dating sites or love interests.
In some cases, the victims in this case thought they were communicating with U.S. servicemen stationed overseas, when in fact they were emailing with con men.
Hanna says the suspects had already stolen roughly $10 million and were attempting to bilk unsuspecting victims out of $40 million more. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. Another Massachusetts member of Congress is now calling for President Trump to be impeached. Cape and Islands Congressman Bill Keating says on Twitter he thinks the inquiry is needed following the special counsel's report on Russian interference in the 2016 election.
The Mueller report reveals several instances of obstruction of justice, certainly enough to move forward with an impeachment investigation. Indeed, if that vote were today, I'd support it.
Keating is the 9th member of the All-Democratic Massachusetts Congressional Delegation to support impeachment. Only Congressmen Richard Neal and Stephen Lynch have not publicly supported the process. Massachusetts General Hospital is tightening its security after information on research study participants was compromised earlier this summer. Information on over 9,000 people was accessed by a third party in June. It included names, demographic details, and genetic information. The hospital says no financial or social security information was accessed. MGH is currently contacting individuals affected. Boston area immigration attorneys say a shift of local asylum resources to the southern border will impact their clients' chances for asylum. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services says asylum officers in Boston are needed at the southern border to address the influx of asylum claims there. WBUR's Shannon Dooling has more.
The wait for an asylum interview in Boston averages between 3 and 6 years. That's expected to increase now, with USCIS pulling local resources and diverting them to the southwest border. Sarah Sherman-Stokes is an immigration attorney. She says longer wait times can undermine even the most legitimate asylum claims.
The evidence of that persecution is harder to come by. Witnesses might pass away or move. It might be harder to get medical records or police records after a certain period of time.
USCIS has told immigration lawyers that no new asylum interviews will be scheduled in Boston for the time being. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
An alert for T riders. There's a power problem on the Green Line E branch. As a result, shuttle buses are being used between North Station and Lechmere. In the forecast, chances of some showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow, then it'll be mostly sunny. The highs will be approaching 80 degrees. Saturday and Sunday looks good, sunny. The highs in the low to mid 70s. Can't rule out a sprinkle or two on Sunday. Partly sunny on Monday, chance of some rain. The highs will be around 70. Right now it's 90 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Americans for the Arts, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, supporting the nonprofit arts industry, which employs 4.6 million people nationwide. Learn more at americansforthearts.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Audie Cornish. There's anger and dismay around the world about what's happening in the Amazon right now. Tens of thousands of fires are burning in the rainforest, dramatically more than last year. Environmentalists say many of these are caused by cattle ranchers and loggers clearing forest land. They blame Brazil's president for encouraging them. NPR's Philip Reeves has just returned from a trip to the Amazon. And first, can you just give us a sense of scale? How serious is this situation?
I know it's a cliche, but the Amazon rainforest really is the lungs of the world. It stores vast amounts of carbon, and that's really crucial for slowing climate change. There are tens of thousands of fires in the forest every year, but this year the number is far higher. Let me give you some of the figures. According to Brazil's Institute of Space, there have been more than 74,000 fires this year, and that's up more than 80% on last year, and a lot of these are in the Amazon. There have been spikes before, in 2005, for example, but back then there was a drought. And environmentalists and climate change experts are saying there's no drought this year, and they're in no doubt that people are causing most of these in order to clear land, often for cattle, and they say that they have the data to prove it.
When you visited the rainforest, how close were you able to get to see evidence of these fires?
Yeah, I was in the west of Brazil in the state of Acre, which is mostly covered by rainforest, and I drove into the forest and started to see smoke pretty early on, and I eventually came across a fire that was actually burning there, so I turned on my tape recorder.
This area of land here, well inside the Amazon rainforest, is burning. I can see charred tree stumps all around me, smoke rising, not just above this particular part of the fire, but over in the distance. All around I can see the forest, but I can also see a large area, maybe 10, 12 football fields, that has been burnt.
Now, that's just one fire. If you think that there are many thousands of these, you get a sense of the scale of this, a scale so great that according to the World Meteorological Organization, smoke from Amazon fires is actually reaching the Atlantic coast and also Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo, way to the south of the Amazon.
Why are environmentalists blaming Brazil's president for this?
Jair Bolsonaro, the president, argues that his government can exploit the Amazon's mineral and agricultural wealth and preserve the forest. But if you look at what he's actually done since taking office in January, it doesn't seem to have much to do with preservation. He's weakened government environmental enforcement agencies. He's alienated two key foreign sources of money for preservation projects, Norway and Germany. He's also scoffed at satellite data compiled by the government's monitoring agency. And a lot of people say that by doing this, Bolsonaro is encouraging illegal loggers and cattle ranchers to cause more destruction of the kind we're seeing now. Listen to Adriana Ramos, who's from the Socio-Environmental Institute here in Brazil.
I think that it shows to people that the government's not interested in enforcing the legislation and strengthening all the strategies to combat deforestation, like a green sign for people to go into the ground and to the forest without any kind of control, because they know that the president afterwards will say, well, that didn't happen, you know.
How is Bolsonaro reacting to these kinds of accusations?
Well, he's tried to counterattack by suggesting, without offering any evidence, that non-governmental organizations are deliberately setting fires in the forest to make him look bad. Bolsonaro tried to row back from that remark somewhat today by posting an online video accusing the media of irresponsibly hyping those remarks. But the allegations are still out there, and it's causing a lot of astonishment and also outrage. There is generally a lot of anger here about what's happening in the rainforest. Brazil's environment minister had a taste of that during a UN climate change meeting here in Brazil this week, where he was heckled and booed. And in the coming days, protests are planned around Brazil to highlight the crisis in the Amazon.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves in Rio de Janeiro. Philip, thank you.
You're welcome.
Climate change is an issue that Democratic voters routinely say that they will vote on next year. Many polls show that it's second only to health care. But today, the Democratic National Committee voted down a proposal to allow a presidential debate focused solely on climate change. And last night, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, who has based his entire presidential campaign on climate change, dropped out of the race. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow is here with us in the studio to explain all of this. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Elsa.
So Jay Inslee, he basically ran as the climate change candidate, right? Mm-hmm. He said he would focus on that more than anything else. And now he's dropping out of the race, what is it, 5 months before the Iowa caucuses. Does it seem like that maybe climate is not going to be the defining campaign issue for Democrats after all?
I think it's actually the opposite. And Jay Inslee ran as the climate candidate, but it turns out there are several climate candidates. So if you are a voter who's looking for someone who wants to overhaul the entire economy over the coming decades to transition to renewable energy, massively cut down on greenhouse gas emissions, you have your pick. Beto O'Rourke has a plan to do that. Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, to a more moderate degree, others. Many have put forward plans that would go far further than what the Obama administration tried to do on this. Inslee did have the most detailed plan. He did talk about this the most, but that really didn't allow him to end up to stand out on the front. And you're right, most polls show that climate change is one of Democratic voters' top issues. This is something that this year Democrats are regularly talking about, voters are asking about. It's a topic in debates. In the past, that hasn't been the case. This has often been an issue that ends up getting ignored during elections.
You mentioned Bernie Sanders. He just rolled out a big climate plan. How does his proposal compare to the other plans we've seen?
I think it's fair to say this is the most aggressive plan yet.
Okay.
Most candidates have a plan to get the country to a carbon neutral state by mid-century. Even if greenhouse gas emissions are happening, they're offset elsewhere. Bernie Sanders' plan, very aggressive. It is a $16 trillion plan to begin with.
Wow.
He wants, on paper at least, all electricity generation and transportation to be completely carbon-free by 2030. So think about that. Not only replacing
very
all...
very ambitious.
It is, certainly. And it is beyond current technology, for sure. We're talking about replacing all natural gas and coal power plants with renewable energy, but also airplanes, cars, everything else we use to travel on that emits carbon dioxide being totally overhauled.
Yeah.
So that would fundamentally restructure society and be expensive. But Sanders and a lot of experts say that is the type of change that is needed to avert the worst case scenario at this point.
Okay, so I don't get it. With all of this focus on climate change, we just mentioned that the Democratic National Committee decided they didn't want to hold a debate focused entirely on climate change. That's something Jay Inslee had called for repeatedly before he dropped out. Why did the DNC vote down this proposal?
The DNC chairman, Tom Perez, has said that, yes, climate change is very important. One of the most important issues needs to be debated, but he does not want to do a single issue debate because he argues that opens the door to issue after issue and that he thinks candidates shouldn't spend all their time doing presidential debates. And I'll just say I've gotten emails in the last few days, press releases urging a debate on challenges older Americans are facing, on campaign finance reform. So the
whole
single
smorgasbord,
they're certainly coming in, and he doesn't want to open the door even on something that most Democrats would say, yeah, really is a top-tier issue.
Okay, so there are 22 Democratic candidates left. When all of this gets whittled down, do we expect the eventual Democratic nominee to make
climate change a huge part of his or her general election message?
I think so. And again, that would be a huge shift from recent elections. For years, the thinking was people vote on more pressing issues. A lot of Democrats think that increasingly climate change is a pressing issue. Last month, the hottest month in the history of recorded months, you see wildfires, all sorts of extreme weather. Democrats feel like this will be a voting issue this year, and they're going to talk about it and say, we want to do something. Most Republicans simply ignore this issue.
NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Thanks, Scott.
Sure thing.
A story from overseas now. It's been 2.5 weeks since India stripped its northern state of Jammu and Kashmir of its special constitutional status. It also cut phones and internet there. The Indian government says those are being restored, but many Kashmiris are still struggling to get in touch with loved ones, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Mumbai.
A man named Ahmed unfurls silk carpets from his native Kashmir at his shop in Mumbai. But he's preoccupied, desperate for news from his family back home. Their phones and internet have been cut for going on 18 days. He's had only one phone call from his mother from a police station.
She was on a queue, and it took her 3 to 4 hours to reach to the phone booth to call me. It was a one-minute limit call. 30 seconds was cry. She cried.
Finally, his mother managed to tell him she's safe. But an elderly uncle had died. By the time Ahmed got the news, the man had been buried more than a week. India says most landlines are now back up in Kashmir, but not Ahmed's mother's nor any of his relatives. Out of 20 landlines NPR called in the main city of Srinagar, 15 of them gave error messages like this one.
This call cannot be connected. Please try later.
Only two phones were answered at a school and a clinic, and receptionists said they'd seen stone-throwing demonstrators outside. The government, though, is trying to convey a picture of order.
Hospitals and banks are functioning normally in all districts of Jammu and Kashmir.
At a briefing yesterday in Srinagar, government spokeswoman Syed Sehrish Askar said ATMs are back online and medicines are being delivered. Schools have reopened, but attendance is less than half, she said.
This is silk.
Beautiful.
Back at his Mumbai carpet shop, Ahmed and his colleague, Shora, wait by the phone. I'm not using their full names. They're frightened for the safety of their families. Thousands of Kashmiris have been arrested in recent weeks. Shora has two sons, aged 8 and 2, who live with his wife in Srinagar.
Each and every second, I'm thinking about my family. I'm very disturbed. I'm fed up because I don't know what is happening there. Is this democracy?
The government says it's taking away Kashmir's autonomy to better integrate it into India. It's even planning an investment conference there this fall. But these carpet sellers are not convinced. They say a lot of Kashmiris are angry. All they care about right now is reaching their families. But once restrictions are lifted, protests and possibly violence could break out. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Mumbai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Children's Hospital, named the number one children's hospital in the nation by U.S. News & World Report for the 6th year in a row. Boston Children's, where the world comes for answers.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Ahead on All Things Considered, a study finds that brain cells from a mouse are remarkably similar to brain cells from a person, but the study also found some subtle differences. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow closed up 50 points to close at 26,252. NASDAQ was down 10 points at 8,010. The S&P 500 was up 7 points to close at 2,932. Marketplace will have all the business news at 6:30 here on WBUR. Coming to WBUR City Space tomorrow, the Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team, hosts a concert featuring Francis Forever, the artist chosen as its favorite Tiny Desk contest entry from Massachusetts. Get tickets at WBUR.org/cityspace.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
Looks like some nice days ahead. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein has the details.
Lots of sunshine for the rest of the afternoon, up near 90 over inland areas, maybe an isolated thunderstorm. Tonight, a few more showers and storms, the first part of the night down to the 60s. Tomorrow, any early showers end, partly sunny, approaching 80. We're in the mid-70s on Saturday with sunshine, dry weather. Sunday, partly sunny, a sprinkle isn't out of the question, temperatures in the lower 70s. It will be cooler next week.
Right now, it's 89 degrees in Boston.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Millions of people around the world have donated DNA samples and medical records to researchers. They form the foundation of the science of so-called precision medicine. To date, most of the results have been based on samples from people of European ancestry. Scientists are now working to correct the skewed picture that results in. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris explains.
When you get lab results from your doctor, you may have noticed that some of them specify different normal ranges depending on your race. Arjun Manrai says for people with kidney disease, those details can really matter.
It can change the stage of kidney disease that you have and when we start initiating things like dialysis.
Manrai studies health genetics at Harvard Medical School, but he also has a personal story about his mother, who was born in India, immigrated to the United States, and later in life developed kidney disease. Her lab results showed normal ranges for blacks and everybody else, but her doctor explained that the everybody else category was really based on results from Europeans.
So my mom responded to her nephrologist, okay, well, you know, you have this African-American range, you have this white range, I'm an Indian-American woman, which of these ranges actually should I be using? He responded that, you know, you're not either of these two, so I averaged the two numbers for you.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's ridiculous, but in the absence, I'd say in this kind of vacuum of information, this was what he was doing as his approach to staging her kidney disease.
Doctors don't have good information about people of different ancestries because so much of the basic science has been done on samples drawn from European populations. One of the most widely used repositories is called the UK Biobank, which contains samples from 500,000 middle-aged Brits. Chief Scientist Kathy Sudlow says 95% came from white Europeans.
At the time that they were recruited and the age group that were recruited, that largely reflected the average across the UK. So because the study was in the UK, that's what we got.
The biobank has been a boon to scientists who want to identify the genes that are involved in disease. Genes are universal, but it doesn't work to identify all the genetic variants that differ based on ancestry.
There is no one cohort anywhere in the world that can answer all questions for all people. And one of the really important things about some of the work that UK Biobank's now engaged in with others in the US and indeed throughout the world is to look at ways in which data from different ethnic groups can learn from each other.
The UK Biobank has helped establish large repositories in Mexico and in China. In the US, the National Institutes of Health is gradually putting together a biobank that aims to have a diverse population of 1 million volunteers. There are dozens and dozens of collections like this scattered around the world, some in private hands, others accessible to scientists.
Broadly, we're talking about at least millions of people.
Ewan Burney, co-director of the European Bioinformatics Institute, is part of an effort to find ways to link some of these together so scientists can quickly see how a discovery in one group applies to people with different ancestries. Burney says even though most of the initial work has been in European populations, populations, a lot of it is relevant to everyone.
How genetics works in different countries, a sort of surprise is that very often the genetics is pretty much the same as you move between different countries.
Where it breaks down is in the details. The same genes and proteins are involved in, say, diabetes, but the variants differ based on a person's genetic heritage. Bernie expects that the new databases will not only help identify issues of concern to a particular ethnic group, but can identify genes that are important for everybody's health. He's particularly eager to learn what comes out of a biobank project taking shape in sub-Saharan Africa.
Because Africa is the birthplace of humans, there's just the highest amount of genetic diversity inside of sub-Saharan Africa. And it's really clear, if you're a geneticist, we should be spending an awful lot more time studying humans there. But then that also is really important that we do that in a way which is empowering and enabling of the scientists who come from these different countries.
The African scientists will get a chance to do their own research before opening this resource up to the rest of the world, Bernie says. Arjun Manrai at Harvard is tapping into data that's already available as he works to make sure that genetic tests and lab results aren't skewed by a person's ancestry.
I think understanding ancestry, race, ethnicity is an area that we're going to see a tremendous, tremendous amount of work in over the next 10 years.
And he says these new resources will help a lot. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Another science story now. In mice, it's possible to treat brain disorders like Alzheimer's disease. In people, the same treatments usually fail. Researchers are beginning to understand why. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study that found small but important differences between the brain cells in mice and the cells in our own heads.
Brain cells are a bit like orchids. There are hundreds of varieties, and they can be hard to tell apart. But in the past few years, scientists have developed technology that can quickly identify every type of cell in a bit of brain tissue. Ed Lean of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle says the key is reading each cell's genetic signature by detecting which genes are switched on.
In one fell swoop, you can get a more or less comprehensive understanding of all of the different types of cells that make up a brain region.
Lean says this also makes it possible to compare brain tissue from different species.
We now have access to this fine level of resolution in the human brain and the ability to compare across and see how good a model a mouse or a monkey actually is.
Lean was part of a team that analyzed 16,000 human brain cells taken from a part of the cortex, the brain's outermost layer. Then they compared those cells with cells taken from the same area of a mouse brain. Christoph Koch, the Allen Institute's chief scientist, says at first glance, the cells look the same.
In one sense, they're remarkably similar. The number of cell types in a human brain and a mouse brain in similar regions of the cortex are roughly similar.
A closer look revealed that there were some differences, but Lean says they were subtle.
On the other hand, these differences can be really quite profound.
For example, Lean says, take the genes that allow a cell to respond to the chemical messenger serotonin.
They're expressed in both mouse and human, but they're not in the same types of cells, which means that serotonin would have a very different function when released into the cortex of the two species.
That's potentially a big deal because depression drugs like Prozac act on the brain's serotonin system. So testing these drugs on mice could be misleading. Koch says other subtle differences could help explain why so many experimental brain drugs have helped mice but not people.
A lot of neurological diseases, a lot of psychiatric diseases that we're suffering from are due to specific defects in particular types of cells.
Koch says now researchers have a way to see whether those types of cells act in the same way in mice as in people. Tom Nowakowski of the University of California, San Francisco, says the advance is long overdue.
The technology finally caught up with what we've been needing to do for probably over 40 years.
Nowakowski wrote an editorial that accompanied the study, which appears in the journal Nature. He says he's especially intrigued by the finding that cells called microglia have a slightly different genetic signature in mice and people.
Those cells are the immune cells of the brain, and you might imagine that studies or insights into neuroimmune disorders, for example, may be vastly affected by this difference.
These disorders include multiple sclerosis and systemic lupus, and there's growing evidence that microglia also play an important role in Alzheimer's disease, which might help explain why experimental Alzheimer's drugs have helped mice, but not people. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. 89 degrees in Boston at 429. Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, signs the economy is weakening have raised concerns about the Trump administration's moves to erode financial safeguards put in place after the last recession. That's ahead here on WBUR. The forecast, chances of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow, then it'll be mostly sunny. The highs will be approaching 80.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by SBLI. Founded by Justice Louis Brandeis in 1907, SBLI is committed to providing families with straightforward life insurance. SBLI.com.
U.S. immigration agents arrested hundreds of undocumented factory workers in Mississippi earlier this month. On the Next Morning Edition, a young immigrant recalls when his own mother was taken away during a raid in Iowa 11 years ago.
Just shattering when I said goodbye to her that morning. I didn't realize I was going to say goodbye for a year.
Plus, we'll hear Steve Inskeep's latest report from Iran. That's on the Next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dwayne Brown. Democrats running for president are taking aim at the Senate filibuster, a powerful tactic to stop certain measures from getting to the floor. NPR's Claudia Grisales tells us the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says Democrats will rue the day they try to dismantle it.
Some Democrats say if they win the White House and the Senate in 2020, they should end the filibuster to push through legislation such as gun control. McConnell is warning they will regret such an attempt. In a New York Times op-ed, the Kentucky Republican defended the longtime rule. The filibuster was eliminated under former Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada to push through several judicial nominees. But McConnell noted the move also led Republicans to push through two Supreme Court justices and 43 new lifetime circuit judges. McConnell said if this movement catches steam, it will end a key safeguard of American government. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Washington.
Negotiations to end America's longest-running war have resumed today with the Taliban. Qatar is the hosting the talks, and both sides have held several rounds of dialogue over the past year, ranging from U.S. troop withdrawals and Taliban guarantees that Afghanistan will no longer be used as a staging ground for global terrorist attacks. But Jennifer Glass tells us there is much uncertainty over what any deal could bring.
President Ashraf Ghani said he hopes an initial deal between the Taliban and the U.S. will bring his government into the process. Once it is, he says, he will let the Afghan people know what the Taliban are asking for and that it's not up to the group to decide the fate of the country. The Afghan government's been excluded from the peace talks that began last October.
Jennifer Glass reporting from Kabul. U.S. allied forces ousted the Taliban from power shortly after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and the group has since faced years of insurgency that's claimed thousands of lives. You're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. Quincy police are investigating a possible hate crime that took place in that city early Sunday morning. WBUR's Simone Rios reports.
A 30-year-old Dorchester man says he was called the N-word by a driver who proceeded to hit him with his car, then flee the scene. Quincy Police Sergeant Karen Barkas says there's still no suspect in the case.
Based on statements made by the victim at the time of the incident, we are investigating it as a hate crime, but we're conducting that investigation to determine if, in fact, it was racially motivated.
The victim says he was treated and released from Boston Medical Center for a broken leg. Police are asking anyone with information to come forward. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simone Rios.
Six workers at Shattuck Hospital in Boston are on leave as an investigation is underway into an alleged assault on a patient in a state-run mental health unit. State police say an employee accused of striking a patient last weekend will be summoned to court. The Department of Mental Health says it's also investigating, and punishment could include termination. The state is part of a nationwide effort to reduce illegal robocalls. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey says a number of major telecommunications companies are partnering with her office and attorneys general across the country. The companies will implement call-blocking technology, investigate suspicious calls, and work with the AGs to identify scams. Patriots player Patrick Chung is due in court next week in New Hampshire to be arraigned on a charge of cocaine possession. A grand jury has indicted the 32-year-old safety after police say they found the drug this past June at his home in Meredith, New Hampshire. The team says it will not comment while Chung's judicial proceedings are taking place. He's played for the Patriots for 9 seasons. Heads up for subway riders. Shuttle buses are replacing service on the Green Line E branch between Lechmere and North Station due to a power problem. It's 4:35.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Abiomed, makers of the Impella heart pump. Learn about a career at jobs.abiomed.com. Abiomed, recovering hearts and saving lives. And Huntington Theater Company, with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, a comedy by Academy Award winner Tom Stoppard, starts September 20th. HuntingtonTheater.org.
In the forecast, chances of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow. Then it'll be mostly sunny. The highs will be approaching 80 degrees. Saturday and Sunday look good. Sunny highs in the low to mid-70s. Right now it's 89 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required, Capital One Bank, USA, N.A. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which provides unrestricted support to individual artists in jazz, dance, and theater through the Doris Duke Artist Awards.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Audie Cornish. More than a decade ago, the United States lapsed into a severe recession, and it was accompanied by a big crash in the financial markets. Big banks had to be bailed out by the government. After that happened, Congress passed laws aimed at preventing another meltdown. Now the U.S. economy is showing signs of weakness, and we wondered if the financial system is strong enough to withstand another slowdown or even a recession. Well, we've got NPR's Jim Zaroli on the line to consider this with us. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi.
So first question out of the gate, is the financial system better prepared for a downturn this time around?
You know, it definitely is in some ways. After the subprime mortgage crisis, there was this big push to regulate the financial system, you know, the investment banks and the mortgage lenders and insurance companies that control so much of the money that flows around the world. For instance, Congress passed laws that require banks to keep a bigger capital cushion. The idea is that would protect them if there's a downturn and people start defaulting on their loans. That was part of the Dodd-Frank financial overhaul law. But now the Trump administration has made no secret of the fact that it thinks these regulators went too far and that some of the rules need to be eased. And they've had some success.
Give us an example.
Well, one example is the Volcker Rule. Remember, a lot of banks were trading stocks and bonds and taking huge risks before the financial crisis. It was like a casino. The Volcker Rule put a stop to that. It said banks can't trade with their own money, which is guaranteed by the federal government. They can't take those kinds of huge risks anymore. And after the Volcker Rule took effect, this kind of trading just, you know, fell off a cliff. Now, just this week, the Trump administration put out a new version of the rule. The new rule won't apply to as many banks as the old one did. So, in effect, the administration is watering down the Volcker Rule. I spoke with Carter Doherty of the group Americans for Financial Reform, and he says, there's been a fair amount of this. I asked him whether this kind of tinkering would necessarily lead to another financial crisis.
No, and I would not make that case. Can you argue persuasively that they will make the next recession more painful than it should be? That is absolutely the case.
All right. There are potential danger spots in the economy that we aren't paying enough attention to at this point, right? I mean, is that what we're hearing?
Yeah, I think, for instance, one area that is potentially risky is business lending. I mean, companies are borrowing huge amounts of money. They have been for a while. They take out enormous levels of debt so they can acquire companies. Other companies, you know, the former Fed chair, Janet Yellen, said last October, if there is a downturn in the economy, a lot of firms will go bankrupt. She said it would probably worsen a downturn. And then here was the current Fed chair, Jerome Powell, giving a speech last May.
Business debt is at near record levels, and recent issuance has been concentrated in the riskiest segments. As a result, some businesses may come under severe financial strain if the economy deteriorates.
And now this, he said, this isn't like the subprime mortgage crisis. It doesn't present the same kind of risk because business lending is just a much smaller part of the economy.
We just heard Powell say, though, that business debt is at near record levels. I mean, why do businesses need to borrow so much?
Well, you know, one reason is they're using it to buy back a lot of their own stock, which causes their share price to go up, makes shareholders happy. But all this borrowing is a problem because you don't normally expect businesses to cut down on their debt when times are good and they're doing well. And now the opposite is happening. And so if the economy keeps slowing, this is a big potential pitfall.
That's NPR's Jim Zaroli. Jim, thanks for explaining it.
You're welcome.
President Trump got into some trouble with Jews in the U.S. this week. He said that those who vote for Democrats, as most Jews do, are disloyal to Israel. He has less reason to complain about evangelical Christians who increasingly see Israel as a place of inspiration. One indication of that interest? A big growth in the number of evangelicals who visit Israel, as NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
American Jews have long felt a kinship with Israel, and when travel agent Eyal Even started promoting trips there 30 years ago, they were his main market. That's no longer the case.
Today, I would say the average is mostly Christian. There are Jews going to Israel, but there's a lot more Christians going to Israel, I think.
Even, himself a native Israeli, now has separate itineraries for evangelical and Catholic groups. Tourism to Israel is growing by about 10% a year, according to the Israeli Tourism Ministry. A tourism official says most of the U.S. tourists are Christians, and a growing share of them are evangelicals. Some are drawn to Israel because they see the reestablishment of a Jewish state as a precondition for the second coming of Jesus. Others just want to visit places they've read about in the Bible.
The locations of all those stories are always right where they're supposed to be.
Pastor Andy Cook leads evangelical tours of Israel twice a year.
Indeed, people, when they come home, they want to read more of that Bible. They've seen the locations, and they see the stories of the Bible as what they are, their history.
The highlight of Robert Bowman's trip to Israel in 2017 was seeing the dungeons in Jerusalem where Jesus awaited his crucifixion.
We saw the rooms where he was flogged. I was in tears. All of us were in tears, thinking about what the Lord Jesus went through and seeing the actual place.
In 2018, Sharon Litton went to Israel with an evangelical group. For her, the memorable moment was a rebaptism by immersion in the River Jordan, where Jesus himself is said to have been baptized.
I had to go, and that was just so dear to me, to be baptized in the same water that Jesus was.
It's not just the New Testament stories that come alive for these Christian visitors. Tour leaders say evangelicals are especially eager to see places mentioned in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. The itineraries customized for evangelicals include a larger share of those sites. Daniel Hummel, whose new book, Covenant Brothers, describes the evolution of Christian Zionism, says Israeli authorities are eager to accommodate this evangelical interest in ancient Israel, knowing it supports their territorial claims.
A lot of these tours are very highly controlled to convey a particular sense of Israel, to emphasize the Jewishness of the land, that this is the homeland of the Jewish people.
The Christian tourists have minimal contact with Palestinians, not even with Palestinian Christians, many of whom are of Eastern Orthodox background. The Israeli tourism official tells NPR the government works with pro-Palestinian church groups, as well as those more in line with the Israeli side, but it's clear it's the evangelical tours that serve Israeli interests.
I'd say close to 100% of our travelers come back extremely pro-Israel in their political views.
Again, Pastor Andy Cook, who's been 22 times.
I tend not to trumpet the political part of the trip. That's not our purpose. But it's invariable that people are going to come away feeling something.
And the Israelis have an interest in promoting that feeling, says author Daniel Hummel. He's at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
There is definitely an understanding on the Israeli government side that tourism is a key way to connect with American evangelicals. And a lot of the pro-Israel groups in the United States see tourism as one of the key ways in shaping evangelical attitudes about Israel.
President Trump may want U.S. Jews to be more supportive of the Israeli government, But maybe that's becoming less important. Christians United for Israel, an evangelical group, now claims to have 7 million members. That's about the size of the entire U.S. Jewish population. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered. It's been 3 weeks since Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, resigned following protests against his administration. The protests were massive, drawing hundreds of thousands of people. As soon as the governor resigned, they dwindled. But on the island, many people are trying to keep the momentum alive, as NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
About 30 people gathered on the town square in Lares, a small city tucked into the hills 60 miles east of the capital. María del Carmen Babilonia Rosado took a microphone hooked up to an amplifier.
Tenga la libertad de expresar tu sentimiento.
Express what you're feeling, she said. We're going to listen to you and make sure that all of Puerto Rico hears what you have to say. This is an Asamblea de Pueblo, a people's assembly. In the days after Governor Rosselló was forced out by demonstrators, the protests dissipated. And so some of those who were protesting are now organizing these assemblies in town squares across the island. Here's Babilonia again, one of the organizers of this one.
Estas asambleas es para pedir el sentir de cada ciudadano.
These assemblies, she said, are to ask, what do the citizens want? How can we improve the conditions in which Puerto Ricans are living? The responses have ranged. Some people have said they want an overhaul of Puerto Rico's political system. Others have focused on local problems, like power outages or roads unrepaired since Hurricane Maria destroyed them. Irenia Vélez stood up and said she's tired. Tired, she said, of politicians who come with innocent faces and Colgate white smiles. They make promises they don't keep, Vélez said. Vélez said her poor health kept her from traveling to San Juan for the protests, but she could come to her town square. Yarimar Bonilla is an anthropologist and has attended several of these assemblies and many of last month's protests.
It all happened in such an unexpected manner. The streets were filled and you know, the focus was on getting Ricardo Rosselló out of power. And so there was no real time to develop an agenda. So I think that there was this desire that was born in that moment, you know, to keep moving this forward and to create something new.
It's unclear if these town square assemblies will achieve anything new. Compared to the protests that forced out the governor, they're tiny. But Bonilla argues that's the point. They're meant to be small, so people can talk about policy and politics and what they should do next.
It's a really early stage right now, and so I think the true impact of them we might not see until the elections, where, you know, suddenly we might see the politicians having to respond to different kinds of questions in the debates and having to position themselves in relationship to citizen concerns in different and new ways.
Tercera y última llamada para empezar la Asamblea de Pueblo de Jayuya.
In the plaza of Jayuya, a remote agricultural town in the mountains, the assembly got called to order a little after dusk. 18 people showed up. Not many, said Elena Lara, a retired school teacher. But she said the protests against the governor began small before exploding in size.
Y lo importante es que haya un germen, que haya un grupo que dé el comienzo.
The important thing is there's a seed, Lara said. We just need a small group to get us going. And as people see that we're addressing problems all over the island, they'll join in. At the end of this assembly, everyone promised to bring a friend or relative to next week's meeting. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Jayuya, Puerto Rico.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
WBUR supporters include Sunbug Solar, a certified B Corporation offering full-service solar system design and installation. Learn what the sun can do for you at sunbugsolar.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, a conversation with author Rian Amilcar Scott about his new collection of short stories entitled The World Doesn't Require You. That's just ahead here on WBUR. Today at WBUR.org, read how local asylum seekers face longer wait times as Boston immigration officials are sent to the Mexican border. That's at WBUR.org. In the forecast, chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow, then it'll be mostly sunny, highs approaching 80 degrees. Saturday and Sunday looks good, sunny, highs in the low to mid-70s. Can't rule out a sprinkle or two on Sunday. Right now, it's 89 degrees in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Mass General Cancer Center at Emerson Hospital in Concord. Cancer specialists and leading technology for the latest treatment options. EmersonHospital.org/cancer. Vertex, fueled by the needs of patients, families, and healthcare providers, Vertex invests in science to strike at the core of serious diseases. VRTX.com. And the Worcester Caribbean American Carnival, Sunday, noon to 7 at Institute Park, with a parade from City Hall to the park at 1:30. More at WorcesterCulture.org.
Hamtramck, Michigan is about to lose its General Motors plant, and with it, in a city that's already struggling, goes a whole lot more.
You know, it's the kind of loss that can sink a small city like ours.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a post-GM life in Hamtramck, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Let's go to a place that's not on any map, Cross River, Maryland. It lives in the imagination of writer Rian Amilcar Scott and on the pages of his books. His new collection of short stories is called The World Doesn't Require You. Amilcar Scott says Cross River was born out of the country's only successful slave revolt. His stories jump around in time and shift perspective. Scott told me he wanted to explore a fictional place, but not in any way he'd seen before.
We have a lot of alternate realities in which the Confederacy wins, which I don't think we need because they lost the war, but the idea battle they won. So I wanted to have a place where the idea battle is still waging, there's actually a physical victory, and these people are the children of the insurrection. They always have to, it's always on their mind. It's always something that they're asking themselves, am I living up to this insurrection? Am I living up to this ideal?
So you create this place, but it's not a utopia. It's not the world of Black Panther, right?
No.
How come?
Utopias are boring. I can't write fiction off of a utopia. I need that conflict.
Can you give us an example of a story that starts with a nugget of something that we might recognize as a modern-day conflict for Black Americans, but that you reimagined?
I think a lot about Rolling in My Six-Foe. That was a story that begins with, I guess, not something that's recognizable, something kind of ridiculous, people reenacting the Underground Railroad, which I had never seen before. I think a lot of that reenacting that I see is sort of nostalgic for the Civil War. And
for people who haven't read the story, to set up the premise.
A gentleman claims that he is reenacting the Underground Railroad, and he drives through the South picking up hitchhikers. And the character, his name is James, my man, picks up a hitchhiker named Rick. So I started with something that was not necessarily recognizable, but taking a recognizable thing and making it ridiculous. And through that, I thought I could examine any number of things, any number of systems of oppression and that sort of thing.
At one point in that story, Roland and my 6-4 character says that people don't understand that the past is the present. And that seems to be a through line for this entire book. Obviously, that's a well-held sentiment in
mm-hmm.
fiction.
Mm-hmm.
How did you want to play with it?
Yeah, so sort of playing around with Faulkner's idea of the past is not even past. I think that we are so guided by ideas that we only have a dim understanding of. We're guided by things that happened a long time ago, but they hold so much weight and power in our day-to-day life. And, you know, I think it's worth it for us to think about things. I think a lot of we hold ideas and we don't know where they came from. It's worth it to actually take some time and think about, where do these ideas come from? Do they still matter? Are they harmful at this point?
We should say that your stories are also funny, bittersweet, and sad. There's a really amazing one about essentially a robot
Two robots.
But the original creator is trying to create slaves all over again. And when his idea is rejected, he sort of lives in isolation with this slave and this robot who the story is told from his point of view. It was a really dark kind of Afrofuturism, right? Usually Afrofuturism imagines a better place for us, or at least with new complications. Why do something like this that's in a way so literal?
I think most robot stories are slave stories. You know, what is C-3PO but a slave, and he's even treated poorly? A lot of times I want to, you know, I'm asking the question of, do we replicate, you know, black people? In what ways do we replicate systems of oppression in our lives without even really thinking about it? How do we replicate those systems of oppression? The idea is that we should be thinking about them so that we can dismantle them. That's the awareness that the robot Jim is coming to.
To that end, I notice women throughout the book are ciphers, mysteries, at one point literal sirens, and are unknowable to these male characters. And is that something that is on purpose? I mean, these characters are flawed, right? The heroes,
yes,
of these stories, they're paranoid. Some of them are mean-spirited. But the women, they can't figure out at all. And how did you want to write about women, and why did you make them opaque in a way?
A lot of these stories are asking the questions of how we accept ideas. And a lot of the ideas that men accept are ideas of misogyny. We're given these ideas. We benefit from them. So a lot of times we just run with them. It comes to a point where you have to really think about it, you know, and really have to ask yourself, how are you going to tear it down? For instance, Jim in the second story, he starts to understand it. He starts to see it.
And he befriends, we should say, an android who is a woman.
He befriends a cyborg, yes, a woman. And through his relationship with her, he starts to really see it. But then he can't really get over the hump. There's a certain comfort in being, not necessarily being the oppressor, but in being someone who benefits from the oppression.
Right. We should say, and this is not a spoiler alert, she wants them to run away. And mm-hmm. in an important moment, Jim can't seem to make that leap with her.
He's programming.
The men in your stories, they suffer for that misogyny or suffer for that inability to connect.
We all do. I mean, I think in real life we do. And I think a lot of times the benefits are in our face, but we don't necessarily see the suffering that we are carrying with and the way that it ripples out and causes damage through generations.
One thing I found interesting is that I'm reading these stories and connecting with the heroes, but I'm using the word heroes very loosely. It's not that they're anti-heroes, but I don't want to be like them. Right? Like, they're not making it, these guys.
Mm-hmm.
There's something kind of diabolical about that, frankly.
You can learn more from a fool than I think you can from a hero.
It made me think differently about what a victory is.
In what way?
I don't know. Just sometimes I'd think, oh, I think he got what he wanted. Unfortunately. A Pyrrhic victory. Over and over again. I started to worry about you. Give someone a win. You know, Toni Morrison died earlier this month.
Yes.
And you've said that so much of black literature that has like a slave narrative is written for and to white people, but that she did it differently, right?
Yes.
Can you talk about how that idea has permeated your work or just her influence on you?
Yeah, until recently, I didn't necessarily realize how much of a Morrisonian idea it was to write to your people and using a black culture as a catalyst and as a jumping off point. You know, a lot of black writers are following that lead nowadays. And I'm reading a lot of slave narratives right now, and sometimes it makes me very sad the ways it's written towards white people. There's in William Wells Brown's first slave narrative, there's a scene in which he tricks a free black man into taking a beating meant for him. He wrote the scene as a piece of comedy to amuse white people, as a way to help end slavery.
Right. Who would read the book, right?
And, who would read the
and
book?
Who would also maybe be a part of abolitionist causes.
And to me, that moment in his life is a tragedy, or it should be considered a tragedy. And I'm sure he considered it a tragedy, but he had to write it as a comedy. You know, I want to write in such a way that people are not necessarily laughing at the suffering. Black life is not just suffering either. There's a lot of beauty there that I hope that people can see within my stories and the stories of a lot of my peers.
That feels like a, as you called it, Morrisonian idea as well. Rihanna Amilcar Scott, his new book of short stories is called The World Doesn't Require You. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the main office of tourism. With wild landscapes and rugged coasts to inspire original lifestyles and authentic adventures, Maine offers travelers an opportunity to discover their very own Maine thing at visitmaine.com. Ballard Spahr, a national law firm providing services in litigation, compliance, and transactions to clients across industries, assessing the impact of national events and legal developments to keep clients informed. Learn more at BallardSpahr.com. And TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Coming up in the next hour of All Things Considered, experts say migrant children held in detention for prolonged periods of time could face detrimental effects on their mental health. That's just ahead here on 90.9 WBUR. Chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. The lows will be down in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow. Then it'll be mostly sunny. Highs approaching 80. Saturday and Sunday look good. It'll be sunny. Highs will be in the low to mid 70s. Right now it's 88 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Experts say migrant children held in detention for prolonged periods of time could face detrimental effects on their mental health.
It's not the normal experience of children to be living behind walls with barbed wires on them and having your life determined by the guards.
It's August 22nd. This is All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown. The Trump administration released the final text of proposed regulations that would allow the government to detain migrant children and families indefinitely. Also ahead, why did it take the nation's biggest news organization so long to take seriously the accusations against the late Jeffrey Epstein? And the FBI and others have arrested dozens of people across the country in an effort to avert potential mass shootings. The crackdown follows deadly attacks in California, Texas, and Ohio. It's 5:01, now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Justice Department is releasing a new report on immigration, citizenship, and the federal justice system. NPR's Ryan Lucas says the report shows the number of federal arrests of non-U.S. citizens for immigration offenses nearly doubled during the Trump administration.
The number of non-citizen arrests for immigration offenses jumped from around 55,000 in fiscal year 2017 to more than 105,000 in fiscal 2018. The increase comes as the Trump administration wages a crackdown on immigration along the southwest border that has included having the Justice Department prioritize criminal immigration enforcement. The figures in the new report indicate that the vast majority of federal arrests of non-U.S. citizens are indeed immigration-related. On the prosecution front, meanwhile, the report shows that non-citizens are overwhelmingly prosecuted for illegal entry or illegal re-entry. President Trump has made curbing all forms of immigration a priority for his presidency. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Climate change will require some people and communities to leave their homes and move out of harm's way. That's according to a new article by leading scientists. Here's NPR's Rebecca Hersher.
Climate change is driving sea level rise, more severe wildfires, and inland flooding in populated areas. In an article published today in the journal Science, scientists argue that much more research and funding must be allocated to help communities understand the options for helping people move away from the areas that are most threatened by those hazards. Environmental scientist A.R. Siders is one of the authors.
Your tax money helps people stay in at-risk areas, or your tax money can go to helping people move away from at-risk areas.
Siders says retreating from disaster-prone areas has long been seen as giving up, but that as the earth warms, helping people retreat must be part of every community's plan for the future. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
In Bangladesh, another attempt to repatriate some of the Rohingya refugees from neighboring Myanmar has failed. Michael Sullivan reports on a crisis that's forced more than 700,000 people to flee the Myanmar military's brutal crackdown over the past 2 years.
Bangladesh's refugee commissioner said not a single person in the nearly
300 families they managed to interview agreed to return. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina said that no one would be forced to go back, so today, no one went. Some on the list told human rights groups they didn't believe it was safe to return, preferring exile for now to what might await them at home.
NPR's Michael Sullivan. With leaders of the major industrialized nations gathering this weekend in the French coastal resort of Biarritz for the annual G7 summit meeting, a senior Trump administration official says one topic of discussion is expected to be whether to readmit Russia to the group, a move that essentially returns it to its G8 configuration. Trump has voiced support for Russia being allowed to rejoin that group. A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow was up 49 points. The Nasdaq fell 28 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. 9 of the 11 senators and members of Congress of Massachusetts now support a presidential impeachment inquiry. Today, Congressman Bill Keating said he supports the effort. The Democrat says special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation found evidence of obstruction of justice that should be investigated. President Trump has denied obstruction. Boston University says it is reaching out to students to offer counseling and support after a junior in the communications department was murdered at her home in Georgia. Police in Cobb County say 20-year-old Erin Edwards and her 24-year-old brother were shot and killed by their mother. The mother then turned the gun on herself. Edwards just completed a summer internship at a New York television station. Power problems are causing disruptions on the MBTA this evening. Subway service between North Station and Lechmere on the Green Line is down. The T is running shuttle buses instead. 4 in 10 economists predict that the U.S. will be in a recession by the end of next year, according to a survey published this week by the National Association for Business Economics. While a downturn could damage any American's retirement savings, WBUR's Callum Borchers reports that a possible silver lining for young workers.
It can be hard to see a recession as an opportunity, says Fidelity Investments Vice President Katie Taylor.
But if I have many years to ride out any volatility, a down market is actually a time where I can buy, you know, shares of my mutual funds at a lower price.
Here's the argument. If stock prices fall, your 401k contribution can buy more shares than it could if prices were high. Later, when the market recovers, you'll be glad to own those extra shares. And some savers are upping their contributions already. Boston-based Fidelity reports that 32% of the firm's 401k account holders, an all-time high, increased their contribution rates in the second quarter. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
Chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be in the 60s. Any leftover showers will end early tomorrow. Then it'll be mostly sunny. The highs will approach 80. Right now it's 88 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the ECMC Foundation, celebrating 5 years of philanthropy and supporting efforts to improve post-secondary education for underserved students. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Today, the Trump administration released the final text of new rules for how migrant children are treated in detention. Right now, the government has to release migrant kids from detention centers as quickly as possible, generally within 20 days. The new regulations would abolish the time limit and make other big changes as well. NPR's Joel Rose has been reading in. He joins us now. And Joel, let's just start with what stands out to you.
Right. These rules would allow the government to detain migrant children and families indefinitely, and regulations spell out how they would do it. DHS would get rid of the current requirement that children be detained in facilities that are licensed by a state. And instead, under the new rules, DHS would be able to license these facilities itself and then hold families in these detention centers for as long as they want. And at the same time, DHS would no longer have to allow immigration attorneys in to monitor conditions inside the facilities, which is especially troubling to migrant advocates.
Because the government would be minding its own shop, so to speak.
Exactly.
DHS has come under fire for its treatment of immigrants in its custody, but these regulations would, I guess, take away that layer of oversight.
That's right. DHS says they'll hire outside inspectors to make sure that facilities provide a high standard of care. DHS acknowledges that detention could have a negative impact on migrant children, but it says these new rules will ensure that kids are treated with, quote, dignity and respect. And the regulations note that these facilities have medical professionals on hand who are trained to recognize and to treat trauma.
What does the Trump administration say this is? Why does the Trump administration say this is necessary?
Well, the number of migrant families crossing the southern border has skyrocketed, particularly in the last year or so, more than 400,000 family members since October of last year. And the Trump administration says migrant families with kids from Central America know that if they ask for asylum, the entire family is likely to be released and they can live in the U.S. while they wait for their day in immigration court. Now the administration wants to detain them to discourage more from coming. And the only way to do that is to, they say, is to replace the so-called Flores settlement with these new regulations. The Flores settlement sets the standards for the care of migrant children in detention. It's been in place for years. And immigrant advocates say it should remain in effect. In fact, they plan to challenge these new regulations in court.
That's NPR's Joel Rose. Joel, thanks for walking us through it.
You're welcome.
Now, the litigation that led to the Flores Agreement began all the way back in the 1980s. Here's a lawyer describing what conditions were like for Jenny Flores. She was the migrant girl the settlement was named after.
The facility was a 1950s-style hotel shaped like a U with the open part going towards the street. And the INS essentially put a chain-link fence in front of it with a sally port and then concertina wire on top of it, and then all around the perimeter of the hotel. There was regular daily contact with unrelated adults of both sexes. So the kids would essentially just hang around for days until, or weeks or months until it was determined what to do with them.
That was Carlos Holguin. He's one of the original lawyers arguing on behalf of Jenny Flores. Now he's part of a legal team that will challenge the administration's new regulations in court. Another lawyer on that team is Holly Cooper. She's co-director of the University of California Davis Immigration Law Clinic. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having us.
Okay, we just heard about what the conditions were like back in the 1980s for migrant children in federal detention. Obviously, the living conditions standards have changed drastically since then. Can you just explain how having Flores in place improved the situation?
Well, the first thing that Flores did was it required that all facilities that detain children for over 20 days be licensed by the state in which they're placed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that will be undermined by these new rules is it'll do away with the state licensing requirements and allow the federal government to sort of self-police and self-license these facilities. But as we saw this summer with the Customs and Border Patrol conditions, that there was a lack of basic hygiene, water, access to responsible adults. So, putting this in the place of the federal government, the regulation of these facilities, is not something that I think that they're, able to do or have not demonstrated historically that they are.
Well, you point out something there that I wanted to touch on, and that is, yes, we have been hearing about children not getting adequate care they need in these government facilities, about children getting placed in sometimes dangerous foster homes. So something clearly is not working, even with Flores in place now.
Yeah, and I think that what we've tried to do is go back to the court multiple times, even requesting sanctions against the government for its failure to repeatedly comply with the terms of the Flores Settlement Agreement. And many of those are still pending and in mediation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, we're on the cusp of perhaps coming to resolution on those repeated failures. Here in the face of all of that, we have these new regulations coming out saying that we're now going to be in charge without any sort of oversight by the Flores Council.
Okay. Well, I want to get your sense. I want to get a sense of your legal plan of attack going forward now. Where do you think the administration is most vulnerable right now? Like, what's the one section in these new regulations you think you're going to be able to most easily knock down in court?
Well, the provision that we are most concerned with is the provision that allows for the indefinite detention of children. Because as you know, the biggest underpinning of the Flores Settlement Agreement was to provide that children should be released as quickly as possible from detention.
Right.
In recognition of sort of expert opinions that detention is, by and large, very traumatic and bad for children. And so now that we have this sort of open door to allow for indefinite detention of children, we feel like that is very inconsistent and flies in the face of the Flores Settlement Agreement.
Okay. That said, let's talk about the conditions that the administration says is going to be provided. They are guaranteeing campus-like settings. They're saying that educational and medical resources will be provided, mental health care, private living facilities for families. At least with respect to those aspects, isn't that exactly the kind of care that you've been fighting for all these years?
Well, that's the kind of care that they're saying they're currently providing. And so I would push back on that and say that that's completely inconsistent with the children's own words, which we provided in multiple declarations before the court. And many times the government has even acquiesced to those children's statements and haven't contested their findings. So I would push back on that and say that that's not exactly accurate when what the record reflects.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Trump administration has always said that Flores was only supposed to be temporary. What do you think is a more permanent solution?
I mean, I think that what we need is some history of compliance. And we need regulations that mirror the spirit of the Flores settlement agreement. Because without sort of a history of compliance and sort of turning over the policing and the oversight to a government that's shown it's inept at caring for children, I think it's irresponsible for us as lawyers or as a country. And moreover, the federal government is on record as saying that they make bad parents. And I think we all agree that, yes, the best parents are, you know, children's actual parents, and that freedom should be the default, not detention for children. And so we need to have that reflected in any final rule that is promulgated by the federal government.
Holly Cooper is one of the lawyers who will be challenging the Trump administration's new regulations to replace the Flores settlement. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Physicians and mental health experts have argued against the detention of migrant children, as we've heard. They say longer periods of detention could have a devastating impact on children's mental health. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has more.
Back in 2018, Sarah McLean spent 2 months interviewing more than 400 mothers at a detention center about the mental health of their children. McLean is a medical student at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York.
Overall, we found high rates of emotional distress in these children.
She says they showed symptoms like
wanting to cry all the time, wanting to be with your mom, conduct problems such as fighting with other kids or having temper tantrums, peer problems, so not having a lot of friends or only wanting to interact with adults.
These symptoms were far more common in the children who were recently reunited with their mothers after being forcibly separated from them once they crossed the U.S. border. McLean also directly interviewed 150 kids aged 9 to 17 about whether they were experiencing symptoms of PTSD. Symptoms like
having flashbacks of trauma or nightmares about the trauma, also having negative alterations in their mood, so feeling depressed or sad.
She found that 17% of the kids had symptoms of PTSD and would likely be diagnosed with the disorder if they saw a psychiatrist. McLean and her colleagues' findings confirm what's been shown by researchers in other countries. Kristen Torres directs child welfare and immigration at First Focus on Children, an advocacy group in Washington, D.C.
Research by the Australian Human Rights Commission found that children in detention facilities are 10 times more likely than adults to experience symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorders, and that those rates increase the longer a child is held in detention.
And these effects aren't buffered as well by the presence of a parent because they too are stressed out and depressed in detention. Louise Zayas is the Dean of Social Work at the University of Texas at Austin and has conducted psychological evaluations of children and parents in detention.
Parents who are under the stress of detention not only transmit that stress and anxiety and depression to their children, but their roles as parents are upended.
Their authority is undercut and they can't comfort their children as well. Moreover, Zayas says most of these children have already been through a lot of trauma. From poverty and violence in their home countries to violence and other hardship on their way to the U.S.
And now we're adding additional adversity by keeping them in detention.
Research shows that chronic stress and trauma can hurt brain development in children.
It affects regions of the brain and functions that have to do with cognition and intellectual processes, with judgment, self-regulation, social skills.
And the longer they're held in detention, he says, the more likely that it will have a lasting impact on their mental health and development.
And it really troubles me that there will be thousands and thousands of children who will be scarred for life.
He says some of these kids might bounce back after their release from detention, but many, he says, will need long-term mental health care to recover from their traumas. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Dawn Brosh at Bunch of Grapes Bookstore. WBUR is on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM and always on the WBUR Listen app.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, why did it take the nation's biggest news organization so long to take seriously the accusations against the late Jeffrey Epstein? In business news, on Wall Street, stocks closed mixed. The Dow was up 50 points to close at 26,252. NASDAQ was down 10 points at 8,010. The S&P 500 was up 7 points to close at 2,932. Marketplace will have all the business news coming up at 6:30 here on WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by BU Academy, where high school students are challenged to think critically and explore the world of learning at Boston University. Open house September 29th. And Legal Seafoods, announcing new retail products with Stonewall Kitchen, including signature sauces and condiments. Learn more at stonewallkitchen.com/legalseafoods.
In the forecast, get set for some nice weather ahead. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
As we head through the evening, a couple of scattered thunderstorms, otherwise just a lot of sunshine, warm temperatures in the 80s, still the humidity around. Tonight, a couple of more showers and storms, mid-60s. Tomorrow, if there is a shower early, it ends. It becomes partly sunny up near 80. Saturday and Sunday, plenty of sunshine, mid-70s. Sunday, a few more clouds, maybe a sprinkle. Temperatures in the lower 70s, coolest at the coast. Monday and Tuesday continue seasonably cool.
Right now it's 88 degrees in Boston. Hey, you know, it took a couple of weeks, but the Red Sox finally won their suspended extra innings game with the Royals. The Sox scored a run in the bottom of the 10th this afternoon. They won that game 5-4. The game took 12 minutes today.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults at home in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Learn more at 1-800-365-4189.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The scandal around Jeffrey Epstein revealed systemic failures in the country's criminal justice system. His philanthropy has tainted institutions in academia and the arts. Now, consider the nation's media organizations. Most were slow to uncover how Epstein was using political connections and money to avoid accountability after preying on minors. NPR's David Folkenflik pulls back the curtain on how two major news organizations struggled with their coverage.
Virginia Roberts Giuffre has accused Epstein of sexually abusing her and loaning her out for sex nearly two decades ago as a teenager to friends like Prince Andrew, eighth in line to the British throne. The prince denies it, so have the other men. In 2015, ABC News secured an interview with Giuffre, by then a grown woman. Here Giuffre reads from a statement she wrote for this story.
I viewed the ABC interview as a potential game changer.
ABC flew Giuffre and her family from Colorado to New York City, putting them up at the Ritz-Carlton on Central Park South. A team led by Amy Robach and investigative producer Jim Hill interviewed her on camera for more than an hour. And the network confirms this. Giuffre tells NPR she sought accountability.
At that time in 2015, Epstein was still walking around a free man, comparing his criminal behavior to stealing a bagel. I really wanted a spotlight shown on him and the others who acted with him and enabled his vile and shameless conduct against young girls and young women.
ABC has episodically covered the scandal, yet the interview was never broadcast, and Giuffre says she was never told why. Shortly before the interview was due to air, Harvard Emeritus Law Professor Alan Dershowitz called the network. He was also one of Epstein's lead defense attorneys. Dershowitz said he called ABC's producers and a lawyer to warn them against the interview with Giuffre.
I did not want to see her credibility enhanced by ABC.
Dershowitz represented Epstein but sometimes socialized with Epstein, too. In an earlier court filing for another accuser's lawsuit, Giuffre had alleged Epstein instructed her to have sex with Dershowitz when she was a teenager. In his own court filings, Dershowitz had rejected her account. The nature of his denials were such that Giuffre sued Dershowitz for defamation earlier this year, and he's asked for it to be dismissed. Giuffre's attorneys believe Dershowitz's intervention convinced ABC not to air the broadcast. ABC would not go into specifics. A few months after the interview, Giuffre filed a fresh lawsuit with more specifics about Epstein. ABC still passed.
There is this element of wondering or worrying that you might get sued.
That's the Miami Herald's Julie Brown. Her investigative series late last year forced prosecutors and journalists alike to refocus attention on Epstein. She interviewed Giuffre about him.
I found her to be very truthful and credible. There were other things in the record that supported her story, so I didn't have any qualms about it.
An ABC spokeswoman says the network's reporting 4 years ago did not fully meet its standards to air, and that an investigative team will produce a report in coming months. 25 blocks south of ABC, the New York Times dealt behind the scenes with a different kind of problem in covering Epstein. It led to a veteran reporter's departure. Last August, the Times chased a tip that Tesla founder Elon Musk was relying on Epstein for advice on who should help run his company. New York Times business columnist James Stewart went up to meet Epstein at his townhouse. He recently spoke to a Columbia Journalism Review podcast about the bizarre conversation that ensued.
And of course, I wondered, why would Musk, if this is true, be using a registered sex offender to recruit new members to the board?
Stewart was not the editor's first choice to interview Epstein. Initially, they had asked Landon Thomas Jr., a veteran financial correspondent. This account is based on interviews with five current and former New York Times staffers. Thomas knew Epstein fairly well, had written two big profiles of him over the years, and 4 years, Thomas had considered Epstein a valued source for gossip on the financial markets and its players, even after Epstein's release from jail. But there was a problem. Thomas told editors he considered Epstein something of a friend, and then floored them by admitting he had solicited Epstein for a $30,000 gift for a Montessori school in Harlem. Tax forms confirmed the donation from a foundation with close links to Epstein.
He was a master at manipulating people through money.
Again, the Miami Herald's Julie Brown.
He did that with scientists all over the world, and educators, academics, politicians. I think it is disheartening if, in fact, it bears out that anyone in the media was part of that.
Thomas suggested Epstein was just a source, not someone he was going to write about. His editors were aghast and rejected the distinction he was trying to make. A Times spokeswoman confirms that Thomas had clearly violated the ethics policy by soliciting the donation from a source. The spokeswoman says editors benched Thomas instantly from any further professional contact with Epstein. Several Times staffers pulled Thomas's old clips. They tell NPR they were appalled at Thomas's 2008 profile of Epstein, published just before Epstein entered jail. Thomas wrote of Epstein gazing at the azure sea, likening himself to Gulliver, shipwrecked among the denizens of Lilliput, as he poked a lunch of crab and rare steak prepared by his personal chef. Thomas depicted a person of privilege who had gone astray, someone who solicited prostitutes, not committed sex crimes against minors. Former colleagues worry that Thomas's guidance on Epstein may have influenced how the New York Times thought about him for years. By the first week of January, Thomas was gone from the paper. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
All right, it is August, and it is hot as heck in much of the U.S. So if you've got central air conditioning, you're probably doing that summertime dance around the thermostat. How low can you set it without sending your utility bill through the roof?
Well, according to Energy Star, the federal program, in order to achieve optimal cooling and energy efficiency, you should set your thermostat to 78 degrees while at home, 85 degrees while away, and 82 degrees while sleeping.
Wait, what? 82
yeah.
degrees
That's
while
right,
sleeping?
82 degrees while sleeping.
We've seen a lot of people with their hair on fire on the internet this week as a result of these numbers.
Jennifer Amon is the building's program director for the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
People were especially outraged by that recommended sleeping temperature. 82 degrees is really hot, Adi. Natalie Doudovich is the environmental scholar at the National Sleep Foundation.
A cool bedroom environment is conducive to better sleep, but by cool,
we know that it has to be actually really quite cool. So room temperatures between 60 and 67 degrees Fahrenheit are optimal for sleep.
Maybe that sounds pretty cold to you, but science backs these numbers up.
Unfortunately, if you have a warm bedroom environment, and definitely 80 degrees Fahrenheit or higher is warm, what will likely happen is that you'll experience arousals during sleep, so that even if you don't remember waking up, your sleep will actually be less restorative and you'll wake up feeling less refreshed.
So what can you do if you don't want to melt, but you also care about saving energy and money? Jennifer Amon says you can try to make yourself comfortable at a higher temperature.
By using ceiling fans, which will move air and can make you feel 5 or more degrees cooler than the thermostat setting.
But once you leave a room, make sure to turn the fan off.
They don't cool rooms, they just cool people.
You can also minimize using things in your home that create heat.
Try not to cook with the oven. You know, go outside, grill your food, have a cold salad.
Or maybe experiment a little bit.
What you can do is maybe, you know, turn up the thermostat 1 degree overnight. See how you do. Give yourself some time to adjust to that. Over time, you might find that you can actually increase the temperature setting a few degrees and still be comfortable.
And if you need some motivation,
maybe spend some of that energy savings on a nice cold six-pack to help stay comfortable and enjoy the rest of the summer.
Cheers.
Cheers. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, President Trump is not facing a strong primary opponent so far. That's a sign of how unified Republicans are behind him heading into 2020, despite some discomfort and grumbling in the establishment. That's just ahead here on 90.9 WBUR. In the forecast, chances of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be down in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow, then it'll be mostly sunny, the highs approaching 80 degrees. Saturday and Sunday look good, sunny, the highs will be in the low to mid-70s. Can't rule out a sprinkle or two on Sunday. Right now it's 88 degrees in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Harvard Art Museums, open to everyone 7 days a week. Take a closer look, harvardartmuseums.org.
U.S. immigration agents arrested hundreds of undocumented factory workers in Mississippi earlier this month. On the next morning edition, a young immigrant recalls when his own mother was taken away during a raid in Iowa 11 years ago.
Just shattering when I said goodbye to her that morning. I didn't realize I was going to say goodbye for a year.
Plus, we'll hear Steve Inskeep's latest report from Iran. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Duane Brown. Disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein could be facing yet another accuser. The Manhattan District Attorney confirms a new indictment against the former movie mogul. As NPR's Rose Friedman tells us, Weinstein is scheduled to be arraigned Monday.
Harvey Weinstein's trial is scheduled to start in just a few weeks. He's charged with 5 counts of sexual assault against 2 different women. Now, the DA has announced a new indictment indicating that Weinstein will be facing one more alleged victim. It's possible that his trial will be pushed back to give his legal team time to respond. The DA will also call in other alleged victims to try to establish a pattern of behavior by Weinstein. Weinstein was publicly accused of rape and sexual harassment by dozens of women after reports of his alleged misconduct were published in the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine in 2017. His case became the catalyst for the Me Too movement. Rose Friedman, NPR News, New York.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is pledging U.S. support to the Canadian government to secure the release of 2 Canadian men who've been detained in China on espionage charges since late last year. Pompeo says it's wrong for Beijing to hold the men, and the Trump administration is focused on helping to free them. Pompeo says he delivered that assurance to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
We started with immediately being very clear about the inappropriate nature of this unlawful detention of these two Canadian citizens.
Canada detained the men in an apparent attempt to pressure China detained them in an apparent attempt to pressure Canada to release a top executive from Chinese tech firm Huawei. She was arrested at the request of U.S. authorities who want her to face fraud charges back here in the U.S. Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow gained 49 points, up 0.2%. You're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. Quincy police are asking for the public's help as they investigate a possible hate crime. A Dorchester man says a driver called him a racial slur and then hit him with his car. The victim says his leg is broken. Police are asking anyone with information to come forward. A member of the New England Patriots is facing drug charges in New Hampshire. Patrick Chung has been indicted for cocaine possession. Investigators say police were called to Chung's home in Meredith in June and discovered evidence leading to the charge. He's scheduled to be arraigned in court next week. He has been a key member of the Patriots' defense for 9 seasons, playing on 3 Super Bowl championship teams. Congressman Bill Keating is the 9th member of Massachusetts' delegation to call for impeachment proceedings against President Trump. He joins a majority of House Democrats in support of an impeachment probe. WBUR's Kimberly Atkins reports.
Keating says former special counsel Robert Mueller's report left too many questions unanswered, and Congress and the courts should step in.
The Mueller report reveals several instances of obstruction of justice, certainly enough to move forward with an impeachment investigation.
Among Massachusetts lawmakers, only Congressman Richard Neal and Stephen Lynch have yet to publicly support an impeachment probe. Neal chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, which is locked in a legal battle with Trump over disclosure of his tax returns. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kimberly Atkins in Washington.
Subway service on the Green Line between North Station and Lechmere has resumed. It was down for the last 3 hours or so because of a power problem. Drivers in the Boston area spend an average of 2 work weeks per year in traffic delays. That's according to a new study out today from the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. Tim Lomax is with the institute.
Boston is at 80 hours, so essentially you're looking at 2 weeks of vacation.
That level of delay ranks Boston as 6th worst in the country for traffic delays. Los Angeles tops the list with 119 hours wasted each year. The town of Tyngsborough says work will be delayed to fix the damage to one of its most historic buildings. The steeple at the First Parish Meeting House was struck by lightning yesterday afternoon. Town Administrator Matthew Hansen says it could take 2 to 3 weeks to make initial repairs to the extensive damage.
Several of the support beams are basically cracked down the middle and separated. There's also a lot of debris on the floor where the roof and some other damage from where the lightning struck trickled down. So there's lots of wood debris on the floor as well.
Hansen says it'll be days before the building is safe for workers to begin the repairs. It's 5:35.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Salem 5 Bank, introducing the Open Account, one checking choice open to everyone. Visit salem5.com/open to learn more.
In the forecast, a chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be down to the 60s. Any leftover showers will end early tomorrow. Then it'll be mostly sunny, highs approaching 80 degrees. Saturday and Sunday look good. Sunny, highs in the low to mid-70s. Can't rule out a sprinkle or two on Sunday. Right now it's 88 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Indeed with its skills tests. Built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. And from the Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's. Providing care and support to all those facing the disease with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at ALZ.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The 2020 campaign is in full swing. That is, if you're talking about the Democrats. On the Republican side, not so much. President Trump faces no strong primary challenger so far. The Republican Party appears fully behind the president, despite grumblings among some in the party establishment. To help explain what is going on, we're joined now by NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hey, Domenico.
Hey there, Elsa.
Okay, let's just start with who is challenging Trump And then I want you to tell me who noticeably is not.
Well, there are a couple of candidates who've said that they're at least thinking about it. They're at least considering taking on the president. One is a former congressman, Tea Party Congressman Joe Walsh from Illinois. Also, Bill Weld, the former Republican governor from Massachusetts, has said that he's strongly considering it. He's been on the trail in some of the early states. But they just don't have the kind of fundraising and grassroots support that party strategists think would be a real challenge to the president. On the other hand, they look at people like Larry Hogan, the popular Maryland governor who's a moderate two-time governor, and John Kasich from Ohio, who people think – he was the former governor there – people think would be a much stronger candidate. But Kasich himself has said that, you know, he doesn't know if there's actually a path to beat President Trump, although he's keeping the door open.
And why is that? I mean, why isn't Trump facing any serious primary challenger right now? Because there have been a lot of vocal Republican critics of him.
There have been some vocal Republican critics. I wouldn't necessarily say many, especially in Washington. But the fact is, President Trump is very popular with the Republican base. We had Republican campaign managers, for example, in the 2016 election say that his base was made of titanium. And there's really no explanation or reason to say that there would be any change in that at this point. He hasn't moved beyond his base. You know, Republicans in Congress, many of them privately don't approve of how the president has done his job, but they don't really challenge him either. And that's because if they want to get anything done, they know they have to deal with the White House, and it's not a good idea to call out the president. And people who have tried have either left the party, been primaried, or retired.
That's true. I mean, there was Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, Jeff Flake of Arizona, others. But not every Republican who's been critical of Trump has left the party. So again, what is the fear of challenging him?
Well, look, surveys have shown that Trump retains very high levels of support with Republicans in the 80th, 90% range. Now, there's some question as to whether that's because Republican voters just love him or if it's because many of them are starting to identify more as independents. But that's actually a trend we saw start for about a decade before President Trump came into office. What we know is this. These office holders privately admit and sometimes publicly disagree with him. Think about people like Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California, even Mitt Romney. These are all people who've had to temper their criticism because they see the power the president wields among primary voters, and they're tactical enough to know that they need to work with him to get stuff done.
Okay, so looking past the primaries to the general election in 2020, what does any of this that we're seeing now say about Trump's reelection chances?
Well, look, not having a serious primary challenger certainly means one less big hurdle that he has to face. And that's the kind of thing that's imperiled past presidents, someone like Gerald Ford or Democrat Jimmy Carter or Republican George H.W. Bush. They faced serious primary challenges, and then they lost in a general election. But it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, because were those primaries really created because their base wasn't that strong to begin with, or did they wind up losing because of the primary challenge? I think some people would argue they weren't very strong candidates to start with. The base had started to leave them, and there was an opening for others.
That's NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, Domenico.
You're so welcome.
Domestic terrorists have caused more deaths in the U.S. than international terrorists in recent years. That's according to the FBI. Almost daily, people are arrested for allegedly threatening to carry out a mass shooting. The latest arrests have come in the aftermath of El Paso, Dayton, and Gilroy, California. As NPR's Cheryl Corley reports, law enforcement officials say their actions have prevented several potential mass shootings.
It's a scary litany of potential tragedy. A Tennessee man arrested yesterday allegedly posted threats online to shoot up a facility run by Planned Parenthood in Washington, D.C. Also, a hotel chef accused of threatening to carry out a mass shooting at his job in Long Beach, California, was arrested. And earlier this month, just days after the back-to-back mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, police in Norwalk, Connecticut, and the FBI began a joint investigation. Norwalk Police Lieutenant Terry Blake says it began after the FBI received a tip that a 22-year-old Connecticut man, Brandon Wagshall, was attempting to buy large-capacity magazines out of state.
During that investigation, they uncovered some historical Facebook posts that showed that Wagshall had posted information that he was planning a mass murder and or interested in mass murder.
And a search of the man's family home turned up other weapons owned by Wagshall's father and rifle scopes with lasers and body armor. Wagshall was arrested last week and charged with 4 counts of illegal possession of large-capacity magazines. He's due back in court September 6. Consultant Catherine Schweit used to work for the FBI. She led the agency's active shooter program program and also wrote an FBI report on 160 active shooting incidents that occurred from 2000 to 2013. About half of the shootings, she says, occur in places of business, with about a quarter taking place in schools.
And everybody has in their mind that the shooters are this type of person or that type of person, and we were able to document the shootings and over this time period determine that, you know, we really have shooters from as young as 12 to as old as 88, and that, in fact, a lot of them are in that middle range, in their 20s and 30s and 40s.
In Florida, the Volusia County Sheriff says two people in separate incidents were arrested this month after threatening mass shootings. Tristan Wicks, a 24-year-old Daytona Beach man, reportedly sent text messages to an ex-girlfriend. She contacted the police. Wicks texted that he wanted to open fire on a large crowd of people, that a good 100 kills would be nice, and he already had a location in mind. Later in the week, another arrest, that after the FBI received a tip about a 15-year-old who said on a video game platform that he would bring his father's gun to school and kill a minimum of 7 people. The teenager admitted making comments about shooting up his school, but told authorities he was joking. An officer's body camera captured the response from the boy's mother during the arrest.
He shouldn't be treated as though he is a terrorist or something because he made a silly statement on a stupid video game.
We had to send a message. We cannot tolerate this.
Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood said his office receives hundreds of threats when it comes to schools.
I don't have a crystal ball. Nobody does as to, is this kid going to be a shooter or not? We don't know. So we have to treat every threat the same and attack it from there.
During an appearance before a House committee hearing on domestic terrorism last spring, Assistant FBI Director Mike McGarrity said people seem to have embraced the see something, say something mantra the Bureau and other agencies have pushed in recent years. He says that should continue.
It's likely an individual, maybe a family member, more specifically a religious leader, a teacher, that will see a change in behavior, see a triggering event where they see an individual become radicalized quickly and mobilized to violence. We need that person to speak up and tell us.
And that's the person, he says, law enforcement agencies need to hear from in order to prevent the horror of another mass shooting. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
You're listening to All Things Considered. CRISPR is a powerful gene editing technique scientists use to modify genes. NPR has learned that a group of scientists in New York is using it in a new way. They're trying to edit genes in human sperm, and the changes they make could be passed down for generations. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein recently got exclusive access to the lab conducting this controversial experiment. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome back, Rob.
Hey, Audie.
This isn't the first time scientists have tried to make changes in human DNA in a way that could be inherited. Haven't they done this kind of thing before with human embryos, though?
Yeah, that's right. Scientists have used CRISPR to edit the DNA in human embryos. In fact, you might remember there was a Chinese scientist who announced last year that he had created the world's first genetically modified babies using embryos that he had edited in his lab and was widely condemned around the world as irresponsible and unethical. And the big reason is that no one knows if it's safe to do that sort of thing.
So why are researchers trying to edit DNA now using human sperm?
Well, one reason is that it could be safer than editing DNA in human embryos. One of the big safety concerns about editing human embryos is that you might only end up editing some and not all of the cells in any babies you try to make from an edited embryo. But if you start with sperm, at least theoretically, you can be more confident that all the cells of any resulting baby would have the changes that you're trying to make.
Can we go back to the issue of safety, though, right, and the controversy around using CRISPR to edit genes? What are some of the other concerns that people have?
Yeah, there's a lot more concerns other than just safety. And, you know, one of the big concerns is that, you know, if you make any changes in DNA in babies that can be passed down for generations, somebody someday could try to use the same technology to make, you know, so-called designer babies where parents pick and choose the traits of their children. And that raises all kinds of sort of scary sci-fi scenarios about genetic haves and genetic have-nots.
and scientists still see this as worth doing. What are their hopes for the technology?
Yeah, so this group of scientists in New York, they're doing this really for two reasons. One is to possibly find new ways to prevent male infertility by, you know, understanding more about how sperm works and the genetics of sperm. The other one is to try to fix genetic mutations that cause diseases that men pass down to their children. Here's Gianpiero Palermo. He runs the Weill Cornell Medicine Lab in New York City, where this experiment is being conducted.
Somebody has a certain genetic abnormality carried in their genome that can be removed, and so make sure that the offspring would be void from this abnormality. Theoretically, in principle, there would be a major, major benefit to society.
You actually went to the lab to see this research in action. Can you tell us what it was like?
Yeah, it was really fascinating. So what they're trying to do, as I said, is use CRISPR to edit the DNA in human sperm. And the hard thing about sperm is that the DNA is packed really tightly in the head of each sperm cell. So what they're doing is they're literally zapping the sperm with a jolt of electricity to loosen up the DNA to try to get the CRISPR gene editing tool in there. Let's listen to a little moment that occurred when I was with June Wang. She's a lab technician in the lab in New York.
I am now taking the sample into the pipette.
That's the sperm and the CRISPR together.
Mm-hmm. Now it's going into the machine.
So the CRISPR and the sperm are in the zapping machine.
Here, I'm going to click start. Okay. It's very quick.
So that's it? You just did it?
Yep.
Now, it's important to emphasize that these scientists haven't figured out a way to make it work yet. And, you know, they may never. It could turn out to be technically just too difficult, but they're going to keep trying to see if they can possibly make it work.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thanks for explaining it.
Oh, sure thing.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. 87 degrees in Boston at 549. Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, we'll take a look at Billie Holiday's life and influence. That's ahead here on WBUR. Today at WBUR.org, read how local asylum seekers face longer wait times as Boston immigration officials are sent to the Mexican border. That's today at WBUR.org. Forecast, chances of some showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows in the 60s. Any leftover showers end early tomorrow, then it'll be mostly sunny, highs approaching 80.
Tanya Mosley is a new co-host for Here and Now.
I've been a journalist for more than 20 years, and I've worked across the country, from Michigan to Kentucky to Washington State and California. I have an innate curiosity, and Here and Now gives me this wonderful opportunity to bring the news to people every day, to keep them informed about what's happening in the world.
Tanya joins Robin Young and Jeremy Hobson Here and Now, weekdays at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Jazz singer Billie Holiday brought emotion to every note she sang.
Crazy in love, I'd say.
But beyond music, she was known for her outspoken opposition to racial injustice. NPR's series Turning the Tables reinterprets the history of American music by putting women front and center. Today, the hidden story of one of Billie Holiday's biggest hits, as told by the hosts of NPR's history podcast, Throughline, Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdelfatah.
In the late 1930s, Billie Holiday was singing in a club in New York City, and she decided to try out a new song.
It was called Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear strange fruit.
And Billie Holiday sang it in that way, that very slow tempo way. The poem, because it is a poem, is full of imagery.
Black bodies swinging.
A kind of sensual imagery.
In the southern breeze.
This metaphor of
strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
Black bodies as the fruit on the lynching tree. The tree itself is imbued with this history of racial trauma and racial violence.
Scent of magnolia.
You know, calling on our sense of smell, scent of magnolia, smooth and sweet, right?
Then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
You have that magnolia blending with the smell of burning flesh, which talks about the kind of barbaric ritual of lynching. It's a very explicit, difficult song. I'm Farah Jasmine Griffin.
She's a professor at Columbia University and author of the book, If You Can't Be Free, Be a Mystery, In Search of Billie Holiday.
Strange Fruit is, at its core, a protest song. Graphic and unflinching in its imagery, in its rejection of white supremacy and violence against African Americans.
And she decided that she wanted to record it, and her record label would not. So she took it to a small independent label and recorded it.
In 1939, Strange Fruit was released, and it became an instant hit. But pretty quickly, it began to attract negative attention. Billie Holiday got a lot of pushback from club owners who would tell her not to sing it.
You've got to understand how shocking this song was at the time.
This is Johan Hari, author of Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs.
To have an African-American woman standing in front of a white audience singing a song against white supremacy and its violence was viscerally shocking at that moment.
And it's around this time that Billie Holiday became the focus of government attention.
She had been so harassed by narcotics agents.
Over the years, Billie struggled with alcohol and drug addiction, and federal agents used that as an excuse to target her. One FBI memo quotes a source in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics saying, "Because of the importance of Holiday, it has been the policy of this bureau to discredit individuals of this caliber using narcotics." And there was one agent in particular who was out to get her. His name, Harry Anslinger.
Come behind the scene at Washington, D.C. and meet the chief of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Mr. Harry J. Anslinger.
So Harry Anslinger was a government bureaucrat who took over the Department of Prohibition just as alcohol prohibition was ending. So he's got this government department that's part of the Treasury Department that's basically going to have nothing to do quite soon. And he wants to keep his department going. And he invented the modern war on drugs as the pretext for his department.
The Treasury Department intends to pursue a relentless warfare against the despicable dope-peddling vulture who preys on the weakness of his fellow man.
And to him, Billie Holiday was the incarnation of everything he hated. She is an African-American woman standing up to white supremacy in a stunningly brave way. I mean, he was so racist that he was regarded as a crazy racist in the 1920s. His own senator for Pennsylvania said he should have to resign because he used the N-word so often in official police memos. And Billie Holiday had an addiction problem.
One night when Billie was slated to sing Strange Fruit, she received a warning from Anslinger.
And the warning said, effectively, stop singing this song.
She arrived at the club, got on stage, and sang.
Billie Holiday's response, typical of her life, was effectively, screw you, I'm an American citizen, I'll sing what I damn well please. And at that point, Harry Anslinger resolves to destroy her.
For years, Anslinger waged a campaign against Billie Holiday, sending agents to stalk her, throwing her in jail multiple times for drug possession, and even preventing her from singing in clubs. And her career took a big hit.
Despite all that, Billie Holiday refused to back down. In fact, Strange Fruit became her signature song.
It would be the last song of her set. She would demand silence. She wouldn't sing if it wasn't silent. There'd be like this kind of pinpoint light on that beautiful face. She understood the import of the song and had become identified with it.
In 1959, after years of battling addiction and harassment from agents,
she collapsed.
She was suffering from liver disease.
Billy was taken to the hospital.
But she said to her friend on the way in that Anslinger wasn't finished with her. She said, "They're going to kill me in there. Don't let them." She wasn't wrong. Anslinger's men come into the hospital and arrest her on her hospital bed.
In a matter of weeks, Billy died.
Billie Holiday had a friend called Yolanda Bavan, who was a very young jazz singer. She called Yolanda her daughter. And I said to Yolanda, "What would you say to Billie Holiday if you could speak to her now?" And she told me how Billie Holiday, right at the end, thought that Anslinger had destroyed her, that no one would remember her. And she said, "I'd say to her, Billie, this morning I went into Whole Foods in Columbus Circle and they were playing your songs. Nobody forgot you, baby."
That was Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdelfatah from Throughline for NPR's series Turning the Tables. And this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Trader Joe's, where new products arrive in stores weekly and new episodes of the podcast Inside Trader Joe's arrive online occasionally. At Apple Podcasts and where podcasts are found, more at TraderJoe's.com. K. Buxbaum, in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. And Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, N.A.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org, 87 degrees in Boston. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as All Things Considered continues, wildfires are surging in the Amazon. That's just ahead here on WBUR. Chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows in the 60s. Leftover showers end early tomorrow, then it'll be mostly sunny.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Abiomed, makers of the Impella heart pump. Learn about a career at jobs.abiomed.com. Abiomed, recovering hearts and saving lives. And the Museum of Science. Tickets on sale now for Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life. Get the inside story on your body at this life-changing exhibition, mos.org.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Fires are always burning in the Amazon, but wildfires have surged since this time last year. According to Brazil's space agency, satellites have spotted more than 9,500 wildfires this past week. It's Thursday, August 22nd. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good evening, I'm Steve Brown. Climate activists have been pushing the Democratic Party to hold a debate on their issue. Most candidates have clear plans to combat climate change, with Bernie Sanders releasing his yesterday. Also, researchers collect millions of DNA samples and health records around the world, but mostly from people of European ancestry. Now they're working to make those samples more diverse.
Understanding ancestry, race, ethnicity is an area that we're going to see a tremendous, tremendous amount of work in over the next 10 years.
On Wall Street, stocks close the day mixed. Marketplace will have the business news at 6:30. It's 6:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Dick's Sporting Goods is reporting its strongest sales in years. That's even though the company recently announced plans to restrict or do away entirely with gun sales. As NPR's Alina Selyuk reports, the company is also raising its economic outlook, signaling it managed to weather criticism over the decision.
Back in March, Dick's Sporting Goods said it would stop selling guns and hunting equipment at 125 locations. This followed a successful test of this elimination at 10 locations. Guns and hunting gear have long been a drag for sticks, so the retailer has been replacing them with more profitable items. But this decision also came right after a highly publicized move by Dick's to stop selling guns to people under 21 and to stop selling all assault-style rifles following a mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. Now, Dick's CEO Ed Stack did not share new plans for more changes to gun sales. He says the company is continuing its, quote, broader strategic review of hunting and guns and would share updates when available. Alina Saliuk, NPR News.
Democratic Party officials meeting in San Francisco today are rejecting a proposal to hold a presidential primary debate focused only on climate change. NPR's Jeff Brady reports the activist group Sunrise Movement campaigned for the climate debate.
Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez says climate change should be a key topic this election, and already it has received more attention than past elections. But Perez argues that allowing one single-issue debate would prompt calls for many more debates on other important topics. After the party's Resolutions Committee voted down the proposal, Sunrise Movement activists disrupted the meeting by walking out and singing.
Which side are you on?
Sunrise organizers say climate change deserves more attention because it affects everyone, and they argue highlighting the issue will energize young voters who are more likely to vote Democratic. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
The Taliban and the U.S. are meeting in Doha in the ninth round of talks to end the war. Jennifer Glass in Kabul says there's much uncertainty over what any deal would bring.
President Ashraf Ghani said he hopes an initial deal between the Taliban and the U.S. will bring his government into the process. Once it is, he says, he will let the Afghan people know what the Taliban are asking for and that it's not up to the group to decide the fate of the country. The Afghan government's been excluded from the peace talks that began last October.
Jennifer Glass in Kabul. With Fed policymakers, economists, and others gathering this weekend for the central bank's annual monetary policy retreat in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, much of the attention is likely to be focused on what the Fed needs to do as it tries to avert a possible recession. Fed policymakers cut interest rates a quarter of a point last month, and many economists expect more cuts could be coming. However, with the U.S.-China trade war and other factors affecting global growth, it's not clear whether rate cuts alone will calm markets. The Dow was up 49 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good evening. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. Quincy police are investigating a possible hate crime that took place in that city early Sunday morning. WBUR's Simone Rios reports.
A 30-year-old Dorchester man says he was called the N-word by a driver who proceeded to hit him with his car, then flee the scene. Quincy Police Sergeant Karen Barkas says there's still no suspect in the case.
Based on statements made by the victim at the time of the incident, we are investigating it as a hate crime, but we're conducting that investigation to determine if, in fact, it was racially motivated.
The victim says he was treated and released from Boston Medical Center for a broken leg. Police are asking anyone with information to come forward. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simone Rios.
40 priests in Vermont have faced credible and substantiated accusations of sexual abuse against minors since 1950. That's the finding of a report released today by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington, Vermont. None of the priests are still in the ministry. The head of the diocese says he hopes the release of the names can help the victims heal. Mass General Hospital is tightening its security after information on research study participants was compromised earlier this summer. Information on over 9,000 people was accessed by a third party in June. It included names, demographic details, and genetic information. The hospital says no financial or social security information was accessed. Boston Celtics legend Bob Cousy has been awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Trump. In a ceremony at the White House, the president praised Cousy and his life on and off the court. Cousy joked that at the age 91, if he had known he was going to be eulogized, he would have done the decent thing and died.
Only in America could my story have been told. I'm here to say that I'm easily the most fortunate, lucky SOB on the planet.
Cousy says this award completes what he called his life's cycle, reaching a level that he'd never dreamed of. In the forecast, chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight. Lows will be down in the 60s. Any leftover showers will end early tomorrow. Then it'll be mostly sunny, highs approaching 80 degrees. Right now it's 87 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Audie Cornish. There's anger and dismay around the world about what's happening in the Amazon right now. Tens of thousands of fires are burning in the rainforest, dramatically more than last year. Environmentalists say many of these are caused by cattle ranchers and loggers clearing forest land. They blame Brazil's president for encouraging them. NPR's Philip Reeves has just returned from a trip to the Amazon. And first, can you just give us a sense of scale? How serious is this situation?
I know it's a cliche, but the Amazon rainforest really is the lungs of the world. It stores vast amounts of carbon, and that's really crucial for slowing climate change. There are tens of thousands of fires in the forest every year, but this year the number is far higher. Let me give you some of the figures. According to Brazil's Institute of Space, there have been more than 74,000 fires this year, and that's up more than 80% on last year, and a lot of these are in the Amazon. There have been spikes before, in 2005, for example, but back then there was a drought. And environmentalists and climate change experts are saying there's no drought this year, and they're in no doubt that people are causing most of these in order to clear land, often for cattle, and they say that they have the data to prove it.
When you visited the rainforest, how close were you able to get to see evidence of these fires?
Yeah, I was in the west of Brazil in the state of Acre, which is mostly covered by rainforest, and I drove into the forest and started to see smoke pretty early on, and I eventually came across a fire that was actually burning there, so I turned on my tape recorder.
This area of land here, well inside the Amazon rainforest, is burning. I can see charred tree stumps all around me, smoke rising, not just above this particular part of the fire, but over in the distance. All around I can see the forest, but I can also see a large area, maybe 10, 12 football fields, that has been burnt.
Now, that's just one fire. If you think that there are many thousands of these, you get a sense of the scale of this. A scale so great that, according to the World Meteorological Organization, smoke from Amazon fires is actually reaching the Atlantic coast and also Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo, way to the south of the Amazon.
Why are environmentalists blaming Brazil's president for this?
Jair Bolsonaro, the president, argues that his government can exploit the Amazon's mineral and agricultural wealth and preserve the forest. But if you look at what he's actually done since taking office in January, it doesn't seem to have much to do with preservation. He's weakened government environmental enforcement agencies. He's alienated two key foreign sources of money for preservation projects, Norway and Germany. He's also scoffed at satellite data compiled by the government's monitoring agency. And a lot of people say that by doing this, Bolsonaro is encouraging illegal loggers and cattle ranchers to cause more destruction of the kind we're seeing now. Listen to Adriana Ramos, who's from the Socio-Environmental Institute here in Brazil.
I think that it shows to people that the government's not interested in enforcing the legislation and strengthening all the strategies to combat deforestation, like a green sign for people to go into the ground and to the forest without any kind of control, because they know that the president afterwards will say, well, that didn't happen, you know.
How is Bolsonaro reacting to these kinds of accusations?
Well, he's tried to counterattack by suggesting, without offering any evidence, that non-governmental organizations are deliberately setting fires in the forest to make him look bad. Bolsonaro tried to row back from that remark somewhat today by posting an online video accusing the media of irresponsibly hyping those remarks. But the allegations are still out there, and it's causing a lot of astonishment and also outrage. There is generally a lot of anger here about what's happening in the rainforest. Brazil's environment minister had a taste of that during a UN climate change meeting here in Brazil this week, where he was heckled and booed. And in the coming days, protests are planned around Brazil to highlight the crisis in the Amazon.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves in Rio de Janeiro. Philip, thank you.
You're welcome.
Climate change is an issue that Democratic voters routinely say that they will vote on next year. Many polls show that it's second only to health care. But today, the Democratic National Committee voted down a proposal to allow a presidential debate focused solely on climate change. And last night, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, who has based his entire presidential campaign on climate change, dropped out of the race. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow is here with us in the studio to explain all of this. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Elsa.
So Jay Inslee, he basically ran as the climate change candidate, right? Mm-hmm. He said he would focus on that more than anything else. And now he's dropping out of the race, 5 months before the Iowa caucuses. Does it seem like that maybe climate is not going to be the defining campaign issue for Democrats after all?
I think it's actually the opposite. And Jay Inslee ran as the climate candidate, but it turns out there are several climate candidates. So if you are a voter who's looking for someone who wants to overhaul the entire economy over the coming decades to transition to renewable energy, massively cut down on greenhouse gas emissions, you have your pick. Beto O'Rourke has a plan to do that. Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, to a more moderate degree, others. Many have put forward plans that would go far further than what the Obama administration tried to do on this. Inslee did have the most detailed plan. He did talk about this the most, but that really didn't allow him to end up to stand out on the front. And you're right, most polls show that climate change is one of Democratic voters' top issues. This is something that this year Democrats are regularly talking about, voters are asking about. It's a topic in debates. In the past, that hasn't been the case. This has often been an issue that ends up getting ignored during elections.
You mentioned Bernie Sanders. He just rolled out a big climate plan. How does his proposal compare to the other plans we've seen?
I think it's fair to say this is the most aggressive plan yet.
Okay.
Most candidates have a plan to get the country to a carbon neutral state by mid-century. Even if greenhouse gas emissions are happening, they're offset elsewhere. Bernie Sanders' plan, very aggressive. It is a $16 trillion plan to begin with.
Wow.
He wants, on paper at least, all electricity generation and transportation to be completely carbon-free by 2030. So think about that. Not only replacing
very
all...
very ambitious.
It is, certainly. And it is beyond current technology, for sure. We're talking about replacing all natural gas and coal power plants with renewable energy, but also airplanes, cars, everything else we use to travel on that emits carbon dioxide being totally overhauled.
Yeah.
So that would fundamentally restructure society and be expensive. But Sanders and a lot of experts say that is the type of change that is needed to avert the worst case scenario at this point.
Okay, so I don't get it. With all of this focus on climate change, we just mentioned that the Democratic National Committee decided they didn't want to hold a debate focused entirely on climate change. That's something Jay Inslee had called for repeatedly before he dropped out. Why did the DNC vote down this proposal?
The DNC chairman, Tom Perez, has said that, yes, climate change is very important. One of the most important issues needs to be debated, but he does not want to do a single issue debate because he argues that opens the door to issue after issue and that he thinks candidates shouldn't spend all their time doing presidential debates. And I'll just say I've gotten emails in the last few days, press releases urging a debate on challenges older Americans are facing, on campaign finance reform. So the
whole
single
smorgasbord, yeah.
They're certainly coming in, and he doesn't want to open the door even on something that most Democrats would say, yeah, really is a top-tier issue.
Okay, so there are 22 Democratic candidates left. When all of this gets whittled down, do we expect the eventual Democratic nominee to make climate change a huge part of his or her general election message?
I think so. And again, that would be a huge shift from recent elections. For years, the thinking was people vote on more pressing issues. A lot of Democrats think that increasingly climate change is a pressing issue. Last month, the hottest month in the history of recorded months.
Yeah.
You see wildfires, all sorts of extreme weather. Democrats feel like this will be a voting issue this year, and they're going to talk about it and say, we want to do something. Most Republicans simply ignore this issue.
NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Thanks, Scott.
Sure thing.
A story from overseas now. It's been 2.5 weeks since India stripped its northern state of Jammu and Kashmir of its special constitutional status. It also cut phones and internet there. The Indian government says those are being restored, but many Kashmiris are still struggling to get in touch with loved ones, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Mumbai.
A man named Ahmed unfurls silk carpets from his native Kashmir at his shop in Mumbai. But he's preoccupied, desperate for news from his family back home. Their phones and internet have been cut for going on 18 days. He's had only one phone call from his mother from a police station.
She was on a queue, and it took her
3 to 4 hours to reach to the phone booth to call me. It was a 1 minute limit call. 30 seconds was cry. She cried.
Finally, his mother managed to tell him she's safe, but an elderly uncle had died. By the time Ahmed got the news, the man had been buried more than a week. India says most landlines are now back up in Kashmir, but not Ahmed's mother's nor any of his relatives. Out of 20 landlines NPR called in the main city of Srinagar, 15 of them gave error messages like this one.
This call cannot be connected. Please try later.
Only two phones were answered at a school and a clinic, and receptionists said they'd seen stone-throwing demonstrators outside. The government, though, is trying to convey a picture of order.
Hospitals and banks are functioning normally in all districts of Jammu and Kashmir.
At a briefing yesterday in Srinagar, government spokeswoman Syed Sehrish Askar said ATMs are back online and medicines are being delivered. Schools have reopened, but attendance is less than half, she said.
This is silk.
Beautiful.
Back at his Mumbai carpet shop, Ahmed and his colleague Shora wait by the phone. I'm not using their full names. They're frightened for the safety of their families. Thousands of Kashmiris have been arrested in recent weeks. Shora has two sons, aged 8 and 2, who live with his wife in Srinagar.
Each and every second, I am thinking about my family. I'm very disturbed. I'm fed up because I don't know what is happening there. Is this democracy?
The government says it's taking away Kashmir's autonomy to better integrate it into India. It's even planning an investment conference there this fall. But these carpet sellers are not convinced. They say a lot of Kashmiris are angry. All they care about right now is reaching their families. But once restrictions are lifted, protests and possibly violence could break out. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Mumbai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Harvard Art Museums, open to everyone 7 days a week. Take a closer look. HarvardArtMuseums.org.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, a study finds that brain cells from a mouse are remarkably similar to the brain cells of a person, but the study has also found some subtle differences. On Wall Street, stocks closed the day mixed. The Dow up 50 points, closing at 26,252. NASDAQ down 10 points at 8,010. And the S&P 500 was up 7 points to close at 2,932. Marketplace will have all the business news coming up in about 11 minutes at 6:30 here on WBUR. Check out WBUR's opinion page, Cognoscenti, today, curbing hate online and the violence it incites in the real world. You can subscribe to Cognoscenti at wbur.org/newsletters.
Funding for WBUR's business report comes from Vertex, a proud contributor of Massachusetts' innovation ecosystem. Fueled by the needs of patients, families, doctors, and nurses, Vertex invests in science to develop new medicines and strike at the core of serious diseases. Learn more at VRTX.com.
We have some pleasant weather on the horizon. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
It's a warm evening across southern New England, lots of humidity and a couple of storms around, but most of us are dry, temperatures in the 80s. Later on tonight, another round of showers and storms, especially late at night, temperatures in the mid-60s. Any showers end early Friday, it becomes partly sunny from north to south, up near 80, turning cooler Saturday, mid-70s with sunshine, even cooler on Sunday, only in the lower 70s, a blend of clouds and sun, and a brief sprinkle. Early next week is also seasonably cool.
Right now it's 86 degrees in Boston. This is 90.9 WBUR.
WBUR supporters include GEICO, proudly offering insurance in Massachusetts for your car and more. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. And Spot On, the dog containment and tracking system that helps make the world your backyard. Learn more at spotoncaller.com.
Thank you.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Millions of people around the world have donated DNA samples and medical records to researchers. They form the foundation of the science of so-called precision medicine. To date, most of the results have been based on samples from people of European ancestry. Scientists are now working to correct the skewed picture that results in. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris explains.
When you get lab results from your doctor, you may have noticed that some of them specify different normal ranges depending on your race. Arjun Manrai says for people with kidney disease, those details can really matter.
It can change the stage of kidney disease that you have and when we start initiating things like dialysis.
Manrai studies health genetics at Harvard Medical School, but he also has a personal story about his mother, who was born in India, immigrated to the United States, and later in life developed kidney disease. Her lab results showed normal ranges for blacks and everybody else, but her doctor explained that the everybody else category was really based on results from Europeans.
So my mom responded to her nephrologist, okay, well, you know, you have this African-American range, you have this white range, I'm an Indian-American woman, which of these ranges actually should I be using? He responded that, you know, you're not either of these two, so I averaged the two numbers for you.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's ridiculous, but in the absence, I'd say in this kind of vacuum of information, this was what he was doing as his approach to staging her kidney disease.
Doctors don't have good information about people of different ancestries because so much of the basic science has been done on samples drawn from European populations. One of the most widely used repositories is called the UK Biobank, which contains samples from 500,000 middle-aged Brits. Chief Scientist Kathy Sudlow says 95% came from white Europeans.
At the time that they were recruited and the age group that were recruited, that largely reflected the average across the UK. So because the study was in the UK, that's what we got.
The biobank has been a boon to scientists who want to identify the genes that are involved in disease. Genes are universal, but it doesn't work to identify all the genetic variants that differ based on ancestry.
There is no one cohort anywhere in the world that can answer all questions for all people. And one of the really important things about some of the work that UK Biobank's now engaged in with others in the US and indeed throughout the world is to look at ways in which data from different ethnic groups can learn from each other.
The UK Biobank has helped establish large repositories in Mexico and in China. In the US, the National Institutes of Health is gradually putting together a biobank that aims to have a diverse population of 1 million volunteers. There are dozens and dozens of collections like this scattered around the world, some in private hands, others accessible to scientists.
Broadly, we're talking about at least millions of people.
Ewan Burney, co-director of the European Bioinformatics Institute, is part of an effort to find ways to link some of these together so scientists can quickly see how a discovery in one group applies to people with different ancestries. Burney says even though most of the initial work has been in European populations, a lot of it is relevant to everyone.
How genetics works in different countries, a sort of surprise is that very often the genetics is pretty much the same as you move between different countries.
Where it breaks down is in the details. The same genes and proteins are involved in, say, diabetes, but the variants differ based on a person's genetic heritage. Burney expects that the new databases will not only help identify issues of concern to a particular ethnic group, but can identify genes that are important for everybody's health. He's particularly eager to learn what comes out of a biobank project taking shape in sub-Saharan Africa.
Because Africa is the birthplace of humans, there's just the highest amount of genetic diversity inside of sub-Saharan Africa. And it's really clear if you're a geneticist, we should be spending an awful lot more time studying humans there. But then that also is really important that we do that in a way which is empowering and enabling of the scientists who come from these different countries.
The African scientists will get a chance to do their own research before opening this resource up to the rest of the world, Burney says. Arjun Manrai at Harvard is tapping into data that's already available as he works to make sure that genetic tests and lab results aren't skewed by a person's ancestry.
I think understanding ancestry, race, ethnicity is an area that we're going to see a tremendous, tremendous amount of work in over the next 10 years.
And he says these new resources will help a lot. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Another science story now. In mice, it's possible to treat brain disorders like Alzheimer's disease. In people, the same treatments usually fail. Researchers are beginning to understand why. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study that found small but important differences between the brain cells in mice and the cells in our own heads.
Brain cells are a bit like orchids. There are hundreds of varieties, and they can be hard to tell apart. But in the past few years, scientists have developed technology that can quickly identify every type of cell in a bit of brain tissue. Ed Lean of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle says the key is reading each cell's genetic signature by detecting which genes are switched on.
In one fell swoop, you can get a more or less comprehensive understanding of all of the different types of cells that make up a brain region.
Lean says this also makes it possible to compare brain tissue from different species.
We now have access to this fine level of resolution in the human brain and the ability to compare across and see how good a model a mouse or a monkey actually is.
Lean was part of a team that analyzed 16,000 human brain cells taken from a part of the cortex, the brain's outermost layer. Then they compared those cells with cells taken from the same area of a mouse brain. Christoph Koch, the Allen Institute's chief scientist, says at first glance, the cells look the same.
In one sense, they're remarkably similar. The number of cell types in a human brain and a mouse brain in similar regions of the cortex are roughly similar.
A closer look revealed that there were some differences, but Lean says they were subtle.
On the other hand, these differences can be really quite profound.
For example, Lean says, take the genes that allow a cell to respond to the chemical messenger serotonin.
They're expressed in both mouse and human, but they're not in the same types of cells, which means that serotonin would have a very different function when released into the cortex of the two species.
That's potentially a big deal because depression drugs like Prozac act on the brain's serotonin system. So testing these drugs on mice could be misleading. Koch says other subtle differences could help explain why so many experimental brain drugs have helped mice but not people.
A lot of neurological diseases, a lot of psychiatric diseases that we're suffering from are due to specific defects in particular types of cells.
Koch says now researchers have a way to see whether those types of cells act in the same way in mice as in people. Tom Nowakowski of the University of California, San Francisco, says the advance is long overdue.
The technology finally caught up with what we've been needing to do for probably over 40 years.
Nowakowski wrote an editorial that accompanied the study, which appears in the journal Nature. He says he's especially intrigued by the finding that cells called microglia have a slightly different genetic signature in mice and people.
Those cells are the immune cells of the brain, and you might imagine that studies or insights into neuroimmune disorders, for example, may be vastly affected by this difference.
These disorders include multiple sclerosis and systemic lupus, and there's growing evidence that microglia also play an important role in Alzheimer's disease, which might help explain why experimental Alzheimer's drugs have helped mice, but not people. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. On Wall Street, stocks close the day mixed. Marketplace will have all the business news coming up next at 6:30 here on 90.9 WBUR. The forecast, chance of some showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows down to the 60s. Any leftover showers will end early tomorrow. Then it'll be mostly sunny, highs approaching 80. Saturday and Sunday look nice. It'll be sunny with highs in the low to mid-70s. Can't rule out a sprinkle or two, though, on Sunday. Right now, it's 86 degrees in Boston. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the ICA Watershed. Last chance to see John Acumphra's immersive film that The Guardian calls nothing less than epic. Closes September 2nd. ICABoston.org. And SBLI, founded by Justice Louis Brandeis in 1907, SBLI is committed to providing families with straightforward life insurance. SBLI.com.